Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, we are doing the most, but I'm a little bit under the weather. I'm a little bit under the weather, and it's the blood pressure, it's the what, it's the anxiety, it's the what, and then it's the physical ailment. It is going crazy there. And so please bear with me tonight. Tonight we're just going to mellow it through. We're going to mellow down. We're going to listen to conversations, that I believe that we should listen to. And this week I think that we are just mellowing down on conversations from other phenomenal people, you know, and these conversations are the ones that are going to be the topic of discussion next week when we can now engage them and talk about them. The number in studio is 083-288-401. When you hear something playing, please do not hesitate to call into studio because I'm just here with you. Call into studio so that we can discuss the things that you have heard or what you have heard and what you have deemed to see it as important to discuss or to talk about. Okay, so the number in studio is 083-288-401. My name is The Matriarch, and we are out here trying our best. And also, ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of anything that we are playing here. It is strictly for illustration purposes. It's strictly for information purposes, and that's basically it. Alrighty, let's get started and let's get into it.
Satisfied with their partner.
80%.
Oh my God.
Now, what does that mean? The number one reason for separation is not infidelity. It's not poor communication. You know what it is? It's you're with the wrong partner.
You meet someone, the flame is really strong, right? And it's burning hot and you're like hot and passionate and it's all new and everything. But towards the end of a relationship, you just go, and it's gone. How can you revitalize a stagnant relationship?
There's a couple places. One, I'm always going to say this, is who you choose as a partner is one of the most important decisions of your life. So when I see people break away from that relationship, typically I'm happy. What I'm really sad about are those that stay. It's one thing to be alone, but it's another thing to be in a relationship. There are more people in the 50-plus dating market than ever before, and they're entering relationships that are much stronger. If you are 50-plus single, sexy out here, I'm like, okay, yes, you go get yours now.
You've done it. How did you do it?
To have love, you need to have three components. One is intimacy, two is passion, and three is...
Paul Brunson, so lovely to have you here. We're going to be talking relationships and discussing how to navigate them in midlife, which I think is a very busy time in terms of relationships. But I really wanted to kick off by asking you, say a couple have been together for 20 years, like they've just become passing ships in the night. They don't work together. They've got kids. Their kids are slightly growing up and they're kind of dreading empty nest. How can you revitalize a sort of stagnant relationship?
You first, and this is going to sound counter to everything I stand for, right? But first is you should evaluate, are you even in
the right one?
The right one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I believe that the number one reason for separation is not infidelity. It's not poor communication. It's not any, you know what it is? Mm-hmm. It's you're with the wrong partner.
Yeah.
And not even did you select the wrong partner, but you allowed yourself to be selected. And this is something that I believe a disproportionate amount of women have done. You should assess, are you even in the right relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the right partner for you? And a great way to determine if you're in a relationship with someone who is the right one for you, are they making any effort to better themselves and the relationship?
Yes.
This is very important because if you're with a partner who says, you know what, therapies, no, I don't need that. Coaching, no, I don't need that. Reading a book with you on our relationship, I don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
If someone believes as if they have no desire to grow, especially for themselves or for you, that is someone who you can't be in a relationship with.
I always... would say to my kids or my friends, do you like yourself with that person. If you are making that effort to change or to adapt to that person, but you've adapted yourself to a point where you don't recognize yourself anymore, then again, maybe that's not the right person for you because you can't be yourself.
No. If let's say you're in a relationship with that person and you decide, let's still try to make it work, it will never reach the heights of what it could be. And that means that you then are taking away from your own life. When we're in a partnership with someone who we can have a close emotional connection with, what that means is that we live longer. It means that we're healthier. It means that we're happier. There's studies that show that we make more money as a result of that. When you're in a relationship with a strong partner, you get nothing but upside, opposed to a partner who's going to create more stress for you. You get every benefit in life. So that means to me that who you choose as a partner is one of the most important decisions of your life.
Paula, I'm really interested in this because also I see nowadays people, men and women, come to the dating scene with a checklist that is impossible to tick off. You're not the one, shoes, or you're not the one, you were 5 minutes late. I mean, just really kind of ridiculous things where actually I think sometimes when you fall in love with someone, all of those little things that you would have looked at your checklist from 5, 10 years ago, none of them matter because you love the core of someone, but you're not going to know that until you meet them and spend some time with them. What do people with the big checklist do?
In the matchmaking agency, what I noticed is that there were certain people who would come in with literally, Davina, like 150 items on their checklist. And things like good feet, like toenails need to be trimmed, like all of these little, these nuances. Now I get it.
Toenails
trimmed is important.
Yeah.
But if they don't come with toenails trimmed, is that a deal breaker?
You know?
But then there were others who would come with one or two items on the list.
Like what would be the one or two items that you'd see?
So one of my favorite clients ever, she was 76 years old.
Oh, amazing.
76.
Fantastic.
She had lived life fully. And she said, Paul, I just want one thing.
Go on.
I want a man with one thing. You know what that was?
What?
I want him to be able to walk up to the third flight because that's
right.
where I lived. I just need him to walk up the stairs. And I thought, are you serious? That's it? Like, you don't care what he looks like, religion, ethnicity, nationality. What she was saying, kind of tongue in cheek, was
active or able.
Able. I want him to be able. Everything else I can work with.
Yes.
Typically in our 20s and 30s, we have a lower priority list because you're trying to work things out. As we go up to our 40s, kind of mid 40s, at this point, we begin to have the highest checklist.
Right. The longest.
The longest checklist.
Okay.
But then as we get older,
the
checklist goes down and down and down. Also, I think that there is a commonality among the checklist and well-being.
What do you mean?
Those of us who have the highest well-being have the lowest checklist. Those of us who have the lowest well-being have the highest checklist.
So actually you see a high checklist, or if you've got a high checklist, you need to look at yourself and do a bit of work on yourself.
Absolutely.
I think the other thing that people do in midlife often is stay together for the kids.
Yes. It's not only one of the worst things you can do.
And I always say that if you are going to stay together for the kids, right, do the kids want you to stay? It's a question that many of us don't even actually look at. We don't even ask the kids. We don't even involve the kids because apparently the kids are so small. The kids can't make decisions like that. But kids are smarter than we think. And we are number one to say that, we are staying together for the kids. We are staying together for the kids. Staying together for the kids and damaging the kids while you are staying together for the kids. Staying together for the kids. Staying together for the kids. Guys, change.
For yourself? But one of the worst things you can do for your children.
Yeah.
There's so many unhealthy rules that we have around parenting and children. So one is, let's stay together for the kids. A part of that also is, let's not argue in front of the kids. We can have our disagreements. Let's make sure that we close the door and then go ahead. Why is that so detrimental? It's so detrimental because the children don't understand how to have a resolution to a conflict. Mm. They don't understand. They are learning through their parents, what their parents do, what their parents say. They need to be able to observe a parent or two parents resolving the issue. Mm. This is very important. When you stay together for the kids, the assumption is that the kids don't realize that you're miserable.
Yeah, but they know, don't they? Like, they can see it.
They can see it.
Yeah.
And you know what's worse? You know what's terrible? Mm. When you talk to many of those children, you know what they'll say? They'll say, I'm the reason why my parents are miserable, because they're staying together for me.
Right.
So therefore, I'm to blame. Mm-hmm. So the parents, what they're doing is actually backfiring. Staying together for the children is not the best strategy. Not the best strategy at all.
And I think as well, like as parents, if you can be an adult in the divorce and divorce together, but do it in as nice a possible way for the children.
Yes.
I think it's important that kids are part of the negotiation, you know, that they understand what it's going to be like going forwards, that even though you're apart, you're still together, yes, united as mum and dad, but we're just going to be living apart to make it as painless as possible. This idea of people staying in a relationship for a very long time is an unhappy relationship, is a sad one. We talked about the kids. But the other thing I thought was interesting, I do a dating show and it's about second time rounders finding love. And when we're casting for that show, we find it quite easy to find women, because women are more likely to leave and then stay single for 2, 3, 4, 10, 15 years while they bring up kids. Men stay single, it seems, for about 3 minutes. Have you kind of looked into that or thought, yes, like, why does that happen?
Yeah, there are a couple of things going on there. One is, if you look at society, we are still living in a patriarchy. What does that really mean when it comes to relationships?
What does that really mean?
What it means is that we still place a premium on men in the dating market. And as men get older,
they have even more.
because
the good ones.
Yeah, the good ones. As a matter of fact, you know what? That reminds me, we had something called the matchmaker number, which is terrible, but it was the truth. And that was that typically when a woman would come in to the matchmaking agency, she would say, I want a man who is older than me. So my age or older. The man would say, I want a woman who is one half my age plus 7. Now, he wouldn't say that exactly, but that was the matchmaker number. So you think about that. So if you,
oh my God,
if you are a 50-year-old man.
So it's hopeless.
Yeah. but think about that. If you're a 50-year-old man, one half, 25, plus 7, 32.
Right.
Does a 50-year-old man want a 32-year-old woman? Definitely. On average.
Yes. I mean, yes. I've seen that happen in my circle of friends. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
How funny.
Yeah.
And the woman likes somebody maybe a year or two older. Da, da, da.
But she'll take up to 50 though.
Let me tell you a secret.
All right.
When I got divorced, I don't get approached by men very often because I'm famous, so I'm a bit scary. He can vouch I'm not at all, but like...
No, not at all.
But I am a little bit. But I got approached by maybe 2 or 3 people in the few months after I got divorced, and all of them, they ranged from 25 to 40, and I was 50. That's quite interesting. So nobody wants to marry you, like, or be with you in a long-term relationship, which is kind of... I don't want to go and have sex everywhere, but that's what they want. They're thinking, older lady, you know, experience.
But you know, you have something else going for you, which is really good. You are incredibly youthful. So that's a very sexy trait.
And it's not about wrinkles and stuff. I think it's an attitude.
It is an attitude.
Yes.
It is how you show up. It is how you walk. It is how you talk. It is how you dress. Based on how I'm dressed right now, there are people saying, oh my God, look at what this guy has on. I'll never listen to him. Where others are saying, look at how he's dressed. I will listen to him.
Do you know, it's funny because there are things that I have started doing as I get older. And I was trying to come up with a list of things that I feel make me feel more youthful. One of them, I walk with purpose.
Yes, you do.
Always. Like I walk like I'm going somewhere. Like even if I'm kind of meandering, I think walk with purpose because it makes me feel like I'm on it. I've got somewhere to go. I know this sounds absolutely mad, but my boyfriend got his teeth done. I've known him for 26 years. So I've known him for such a long time. He got his teeth done. He got braces. You Americans, you're so good at this stuff. We're late to the game on this, us Brits, but getting my teeth done. And everybody's like, why are you doing that? We're kind of shaming to people that want to improve themselves. Mm-hmm. Getting my teeth done. Best thing I ever did. Mm. Self-love is also loving yourself enough to make an effort for yourself.
Yes. And it begins to then, I think, speak to the seeking of not placing value in how extraordinary you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think this is key. It's like, we all, each of us, and I fully believe this, we are extraordinary.
Everyone.
Everyone is.
I totally agree.
Everyone is extraordinary. And when you really think about what does that mean? What does that mean? It means that you are extraordinary. You're not ordinary. It means there's no one that is like you.
Mm.
No one. And no one will ever be like you again. Mm. And there has never been anyone who's walked this earth who's been like Davina.
Mm.
So you are extraordinary. You're extraordinary. So as a result of that, think about all of you and just put a spotlight on it, opposed to taking it out, opposed to covering it up. Instead, put a spotlight on all of the pieces that make you you. That's a place that I love to see people move towards.
Mm.
And I think that's also part of why you are so loved, is because I feel as if that's what you do. You say, this is who I am.
Mm.
I'm going to fully self-accept, which self-acceptance, by the way, is a key piece to high well-being.
Mm.
And self-acceptance, to me, is even more powerful than self-love. Because self-acceptance is saying, I know all the demons.
Yes, warts and all.
And I'm okay with it.
Mm.
I've learned from them.
Mm.
That's self-acceptance.
Can I ask you something there?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what happens if someone has a demon? What do you do when you can't quite get past something you've done?
Are there bad people? Absolutely. David Buss wrote a phenomenal book called Bad Boys. And he looked at what is called the dark tetrad. Have you heard about these
folks?
All right. The dark tetrad, they are bad.
Mm.
These are the psychopaths.
Right.
The sadists. The narcissists.
Mm.
Machiavellians.
Mm.
Right. Who are purposely trying to manipulate.
In a bad way.
In a bad way, right? So there are bad people. And unfortunately, when you are a psychopath, when you are a narcissist, etc., there typically is no coming back from that.
Right.
You are that forever. So it's like you have to manage that. But when you are that, those things, you typically are not empathetic.
Would you be able to see it in yourself if you were as well? Because I feel like I know a couple of narcissists, and they would never say they were a narcissist.
They would never say it.
Yeah.
Because they're not able to step outside of themselves and feel empathy. So as a result, that person that you're talking about, he seems like he's self-aware, and he realizes, oh, my bad. I shouldn't have done this. And I feel remorseful for this, etc. And how many of us are good people that did a bad thing?
Yeah, all of us.
I
don't think there's one person that's not done a bad thing.
There's not one person, right? You are a good person that exhibited bad behavior at a certain point. That is powerful. Mm. And you are not in this group over here.
Mm.
I think that's a great place to start.
Hope you're enjoying this episode. If you could, remember to click like and subscribe. That would be great.
Wow. Don't know why. Mm. And so she sounds like that.
That's exactly how she feels.
There's so many, you know, places to go. But one key question that I would ask her is, well, what is she doing to engage with people?
Mm.
Because typically what I found is that women and men in those positions, there's so much going on in the workplace that once they're out, they just want to disconnect.
Yeah.
They just
put on their slippers.
Put on their slippers.
Watch some telly.
Binge watch, right? Some Netflix or whatever, you know, and just eat ice cream out of the thing and just.
Yeah.
Right. Before they put on that mask and go back. And so that would be my question. It's like, what are you doing? The other part to that too is it's so important to engage in places that we're passionate, but in circles that are unfamiliar to us.
Right.
This is very important.
Yes,
very
okay.
So you think about the fact that she's a DJ. She's a creative
genius. Yes, she really is.
So creativity is a huge value to her, for her. But I would say, you said she lives in Berlin, mm-hmm. right? So what would happen if she would come to South London, where I live, go to Brixton, go to the Black Cultural Archives, and participate in a painting, a painting class there. The reason why is you want to step out of the circles that you are used to and go to new circles. This is incredibly important.
Of creative, of her kind of thing.
Of similar values.
Yes, yes, okay.
Because she will be appreciated. She will feel the connection, but she will meet new people.
Mm.
You know, living in London, I was born in New York, lived in Washington, D.C., now live in London. Massive cities. However, you talk to most people, they say, I see the same people every weekend. Why? Because we all live in these micro circles within larger circles, within larger circles, within larger circles. The key to meet new people, to add value and insight, and not just romance, but business opportunities and friendships, all of these things, is you have to step out and you have to step to places where you are uncomfortable. I put myself in this category. One of the key reasons why my wife and I consciously decided to move to London was we were like, we don't know anybody here.
Yeah.
Like, we know no one here. And as a result of coming here, we're going to be forced into new circles. We're going to be forced into novelty. And that novelty is going to spark all types of beautiful things in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And also beautiful things in our relationship, because what keeps a relationship going is novelty. And when you have to experience something new with your partner, it's you and your partner taking on the new thing. You know, you're learning new things, but you're also on the same team. Have you felt this way? As you get older, you become more unapologetic.
Yes. Oh my God. Well, I mean, the world's got to brace themselves because the next 10 years are going to be very
crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like this is how I feel. But I feel so, happier.
Yeah.
You know? So, and it's not like just carefree.
But you've done it. How did you do it? Because I think there will be lots of people going, I want to be like that.
It takes time. Like, it's one of these where right when I walked in, you know, I was talking about this, this nose stud that I have. Is I have wanted this nose stud since 19.
Esira shisho, pagyotari ku kwathere opogoro kara wasira ya kweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Taiga njua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo yo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na kene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugo petameko igena cha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano opama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo ukene una okwea kwa thera nukwea pa ea bidhido yiri mwonjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere o unji na hene unokara uishangitha tarera po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na hangona maradura thano ododhina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you
your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
1999. You know what I mean? Since watching Tupac. Like, that was my... I was like, Tupac's got that nose stud. I love that. Then, you know, graduate from college, get into investment banking, have to wear a suit. And,
can't have a nose stud.
Oh, you can... never you can have a nose stud. Never. And then I moved to the next job. Never you can have a nose stud. Then I start doing television. Oh, you can never do television with a nose stud. You know, no one's ever going to listen to you, Paul, with a nose stud. It's like, no, you know what? I'm getting a freaking nose stud. And I think a large part of that, and this is connecting, I think, to this conversation, is being around a group of people who cheer for you with or without the thing. They adore you. Mm. They cheer for you. Many of us are in circles and around people and they only are
keep you in the box.
They're trying to keep you in the box, and they only like you for the thing or not the thing. Mm. So they're the ones saying, as a result of the no stud, we would never be able to. But this circle that I have over here, they're like, whatever, Paul, like, do whatever. And that then allows you to tap into, well, what are the things that I truly do like, and experiment with those things.
So it's a journey to becoming your true self.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I think, says it best. And this is in essence what I'm saying around the people who support you, is that, you know, it starts off with these basic needs of, okay, do we have food and shelter and, you know, do we feel safe? If you can't have those things, you can't express yourself because you're not concerned. But then it moves into, do you feel like you have connection and belonging and love and support? Then once you have those things, you can move to a higher place of being self-evolved. And this is the place where I feel like
that's where we're all trying to get to.
We're all trying to get there. We're all trying to get there. And interestingly, Maslow said that very few of us will get to that place. Mm. But you can't just leapfrog to that.
No.
You have to move through the levels.
So you said something earlier about guys looking for somebody half their age plus seven and women looking for somebody older. How are we ever going to meet each other in our 50s if that's the case? Oh, 40s, 50s, in midlife.
Yeah. Well, one is that's the old slowly going away. Has it gone away? No, but that's one.
Yeah.
That's one. Secondly, is on an upside, is there are more people in the 50 plus dating market looking for partners than ever before. Mm. So
half of me is quite sad about that, but half of me is quite happy because for the 50 and 40 year olds, like, well done.
Yes. And the reason why I feel so happy, I'm more happy.
Okay.
Because, all right, I'm going to connect it to research.
Yeah.
So Eli Finkel out of New York has done some research around the satisfaction rate in relationships, in marriages. Mm-hmm. He found that 80% of marriages today don't feel satisfied with their partner.
80%? 80. Oh, my God.
80%.
That's sad.
80%. Whereas 20% feel as satisfied or more satisfied than ever. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? And how do I relate that to being happy with the 50 plus market?
Yeah.
So to me, that means, okay, the 20%, this is great. And they're probably so happy because they have so many tools today, so many great podcasts, et cetera, to listen to. This is good. The 80% are not satisfied, but they're staying in the relationship anyway. So when I see people break away from that relationship, typically I'm happy. What I'm really sad about are those that stay.
Mm.
You know, it's one thing to be alone, but it's another thing to be in a relationship and still feel alone.
And lonely.
That is just incredibly sad. So if you are 50 plus single, sexy out here, I'm like, okay, yes, you go get yours now.
Mm.
You go get yours. And the beauty is you could get yours any way you want it.
Mm.
You don't have to get married. You can have a committed relationship.
Mm.
You can choose to have a polyamorous relationship.
Mm.
You could choose to have whatever formation you want, but you now have the availability to do it. And because there are more 50 plus than ever before, the pool is larger and there's more tools now to connect. So from that standpoint, I'm optimistic about that. The other thing is when you look at the ages in which people are getting married, you still have I think mid-30s is the number one age range for marriage, but number two is right around 50. So you have a lot of people who have re-entered the dating market for whatever reason, empty nest, etc., and they're deciding and they're finding partners. And they're finding partners and they're entering relationships that are much stronger than any relationship they've ever had. And to me, that is beautiful. So I'm happy about those things.
We're taking a quick break to talk about today's sponsor, Fiverr. There must be a percentage of people that are dissatisfied, but would love to try and make it better. They still love that person, But it's not the percentage of people we were talking about at the beginning who probably shouldn't be together.
Right.
These are people where I always talk about love like a pilot light. You meet someone, the flame is really strong, right? And it's burning hot and you're like hot and passionate and it's all new and everything. Mm. And through life, you know, it can go down and go yes. up and go down and go up. But towards the end of a relationship, it goes down really, really low and it's very fragile.
Yes.
And at some point, one of you, or maybe both of you do it at the same time, but you just go, and it's gone. And it's literally like light goes out, pilot light's gone. It's gone.
Yes.
But if it's still there and you want to make it go, like you want to make a go of it, like what can you do to save your relationship?
You know, that was a brilliant analogy. I may have to use that.
Oh, my God. If you use it, you know, like in this interview where you've gone, quote, quote, like blah, 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 Oprah said this, blah, 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 said that, like, please just go. And Davina McCall.
This pilot light. This is brilliant. But you know what? As you said it, I could picture it. It was going up, going down, going up, and then you decide to blow it out. That's exactly what happens. And for most of that, you're probably hoping I wanted to stay on.
Yes.
And for that 80%, I'm with you. I think most of those are people who you have one, at least one of the two, that say, I want to keep it on.
Mm.
And the other thing that we have to, I think, give credit to is there are a significant number of men, because I think men are bashed on this issue.
They are, I think.
Unfairly.
Yes.
Where there are a significant number of men every day
who are working at it.
Who are working
yeah,
at
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
I got this Bible's message of from a gentleman just yesterday telling me about how over the last 10 years he's been trying everything to make his relationship work.
Aww.
And he got to the point at the end where he's literally saying, Paul, I'm crying.
Aww.
Because I want this to work. What do I do? And that's what you're asking. What do I do?
Yes.
So there's a couple places. One, I'm always going to say this, is counseling, therapy, incredibly important. It is accessible. And there are many forms of therapy. Many
yes.
forms.
Can you tell me a few?
Absolutely. So therapy, as I describe it, means healing. It is healing. Healing can come from different sources. So therapists are incredibly brilliant at this. But you can also be healed by a counselor, which is slightly different than a therapist, by a coach, slightly different than a therapist, by a great friend, by a mediator, by a pastor at a church. All of these represent therapy. But you know what also represents therapy?
Mm.
Sitting down, watching a YouTube video together, listening to a podcast.
Yes, I mean, that's quite a new type of way of, and I don't think people in midlife in their 40s and 50s would necessarily think of that straight away. That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah. And the thing about this is that sitting down watching a podcast together on any relationship topic as a partnership and then discussing it means that you are now on a pathway to managing the problem. Mm-hmm. So that is therapy, right? You're working on the tools to manage the problem. That's healing.
And if both of you are prepared to do that, I think, you know, you might look at your partner and go, wow, look, they're willing to come to this with me.
Yes.
Thanks. Already you're winning, right?
Already you're winning. That is a quick step, and that is a high return from the quick step.
Right.
So that's incredibly important. Another area is the individual work. And a lot of people don't automatically think about that because they're in a relationship and they say, okay, well, the problem is actually what my partner's behavior. It's not mine. But sometimes we don't realize how our behavior, I'll just say, impacts our partner and either increases their willingness to continue to act like an asshole to us
yes.
or decreases that or mitigates that. And so understanding how we show up, why we show up is incredibly important. And part of that analysis can be done simply by asking your partner to give you feedback. How many of us have turned to our partner to say,
I don't think I've ever done that. How did I do?
Yeah. How did I do in that? The only time that ever comes up sometimes is after sex, people will say, well, how did that work for you? Right? But how about just if you were having a disagreement, you know, and I say an argument, right? And to then literally the next day say, you know, did you find that, was I fair in that? Or was I not?
I mean, that's so healthy, isn't it? Like, how lovely. Wow.
It's a game changer.
Yeah.
I, for years, thought I was the most fair. I was like, this is what I do.
That's so fair.
I was like, yeah. When it comes to these, with my wife, Jill, I am the best person to have an argument with. You know what I mean? The best. And there was a moment where I asked, I was like, okay, Jill, what do you think? And she said, you know, I find that you're unkind in these arguments.
But that's such a brilliant way to word that, because it's not saying you're unkind. She's saying, this is how I perceive you.
Yes.
So it's not like you're not going to get defensive. I mean, obviously, you know each other very well, but she's said that brilliantly.
Yeah. The fact that she said in these scenarios,
yeah.
What she did is actually textbook. One is that psychology is her background, too. So she's really good, is that she used a technique that is very effective, and that is that typically when we enter a disagreement, any person, you look at it as you versus your partner. Mm-hmm. This is how we typically look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, I would say reframe, and this will change your every argument, and mm-hmm. that is, it is you, it is your partner against the issue.
Brilliant. Not against each other.
No.
You're dealing with this thing over here.
It's this thing over here that we're dealing with.
But visually, that's so helpful.
Yeah, visually. It is over here. You are here. I am here. And we are on the same team.
Yes.
And we're combating this thing. And what that does is it begins to reframe, and it helps you understand that you're not under attack.
Yes.
You're not under attack. And not only are you not under attack, that you have the support of your partner. And so she was able to do that, which is brilliant. But getting feedback is incredibly important, I think.
How did you take it?
Then I'm open.
Right.
To receiving it. Because
you asked. Because you asked, so you know that you're going to get something back.
This is true. This is true.
Okay.
This is true.
But because some people go, what do you mean? Like, how do you not get defensive?
Jill's deliveries are spectacular, because she also uses the whole crap sandwich delivery, too, where she'll start positive. She'll add something constructive in the middle.
Then dump the crap.
Yeah, that's the crap. The crap is in the middle.
The crap's in there.
Crap is always that gooey stuff.
And then finish with
Then you finish with something nice. So it's like the bread. The bread is the nice stuff. And the crap is in the middle. And she packs it in and hands it over. Yeah.
I know that in a lot of people's relationships, long-term relationships, I have several friends of mine who are married who are like, oh, well, we don't really have sex anymore. And that always slightly worries me, because I think, but is it possible for some people to stay in a marriage and not have sex? Or what's that about? And if there's one person that does want to have sex sometimes, but their partner's really gone off it, like, what do you do about that?
Is sex incredibly important? Absolutely.
Yes,
like, absolutely.
I'm a believer of that, but some people would just go, it's not.
No, it is.
Then it's a friendship if you're not having sex.
You know what? So there's Robert Sternberg is a researcher, and he created something called the triangular theory of love, right, in the 1980s. Triangular theory of love. And he says that to have love, you need to have three components. One is intimacy, which is not the physical piece, but the closeness.
Mm-hmm.
Two is passion.
Yes.
Physical and sexual desire.
Mm-hmm.
And three is commitment. If you have intimacy, passion, and commitment, you have the most full definition of love.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have one of those three, you have some component, like you have some part of love, but you don't have full love.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about that. If you have intimacy and you have commitment, but you don't have passion,
which is a lot of marriages, they have that closeness, they've been together for so long, and that, like, we're going to stay together forever because we're married,
and you don't have
and
so what does that mean?
Well, to me, it means you're best friends. Like, it's not a relationship. It's a friendship relationship, not a partnership, a marriage.
So this is interesting. I'm with you, but not with you.
Okay, go. Right. Tell me.
So I'll tell you where I'm with you.
Mm.
Where I'm with you is, yeah, they're best friends.
So can you be married to your best friend and not?
Some people can.
Okay.
Because there are 1,000 types of relationships. You know, living apart but being together, those relationships yes. are now one of, like, that's the trend is where you have a partner and your partner sleeps in another room, or you have a partner and they sleep in a different house. Right. And you see each other once a month and that's your marriage and you're,
and they work great.
And they work
I've
great.
I've seen that happen sometimes. Yeah.
So so that's why I think knowing what you want and ensuring that your partner has those same goals is incredibly important. Now, do most people want that? No.
No.
Most people want their partner to be their best friend, to do backflips in the bedroom with them, and to be committed to them for life. Mm. That's what most of us want. So in that relationship, if you feel like, okay, you're not getting that out of your partner and you want to create more of that, you want to get more of that, the novelty, the therapy, these are incredibly important. But I always say, just like in the argument, I say it goes back to you. You want to begin to evaluate you. And I'll bring my relationship into this. Right now, my wife and I, being married 23 years, we have more sex now than we did year two of our marriage.
And why?
Now, I think there's...
How?
Yeah, there,
not why. I don't know why.
How does that happen? How does that happen? Well, technically, Davina, you see, what I do is I take my... No.
Yes.
Okay, what are some of the key reasons? One key reason, and very few people talk about this when it comes to sex, is that we're healthier. Mm. We're literally healthier. This is incredibly important. When I say healthier, is that, like, literally, we work out.
More
consistently.
Eat better.
We eat better.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We sleep. You know, I was talking to Karen Gurney, who I think is one of the top sex therapists in the
Karen
world.
Oh, Karen, yeah, she's amazing.
Yes.
She's so good.
And I asked her, I said, what's the best thing to do if you have a poor sex life? And you know, a lot of people say pop pills, drink this, do that. And she said, get a good night's sleep. But think about what she's saying. What she's saying is that when you are rested, when you have less stress, when you feel safe within yourself.
Yes.
You're better able to then express, and sex is part of that expression. But if you feel under stress, if you feel like you've eaten a terrible diet and you just feel heavy, if you are sleep deprived, do you want to have sex? Absolutely not. Whether you're 25 or you're 55. And so your individual health, your personal health is incredibly important. And I think that's one of the key reasons why sex begins to deteriorate. Now, there are other reasons. The emotional intimacy sometimes slips and all these, but our actual health, this is why it's so important for us to take care of this vessel that we have. Incredibly important.
It sounds like you and your wife talk a lot, you know, and I, it always makes me laugh, this idea of a couple being married for such a long time. And then, you know, sometimes people say to me, like, it's got to the point where he'll go fancy a shag tonight, you know, like, it's literally that kind of, that's foreplay. And then, but actually, if they said having a drink or something on a sofa, I'm trying to picture kind of how that could sound better. It would be like, if I was to take you to bed tonight, what would you like me to do to you? Or what would you like to do together? And you go, what are you talking about? And you go, well, I'm just asking. And then you start talking about it. And then bang, like, you're already in the mood.
Yes. So you know what the issue here is? And this is something that guys, fellas, we have to stop this. Or I'm sorry, we have to appreciate this, is that we all are all turned on. And when I say turned on, is there's what's called spontaneity, spontaneous sex. And then there's others who it takes us longer to let I say, warm up to sex.
Well, I think that's men and women, isn't it? It's like...
Exactly. Yeah. Men and women. So there's a big gender difference. And then also in terms of age. So fellas, if you have a wife and she's in her 40s or 50s or 60s, you coming home and saying, let's get it on right now. It's... not going down the way that you want it. So that's one thing, is that we have to appreciate that. The other thing is that we have to step outside of the script. Now, there is a standard script that happens in heterosexual sex, and that is oral sex the wife delivers oral sex to the husband or to the male partner. Then there's vaginal sex that happens as long as the husband is able, once he ejaculates, then that's it. It's a wrap. This is the standard script to sex. And what happens is you could imagine if that is what you're used to and you're a woman who doesn't climax as a result of that, there's no orgasm as a result of that. And we know that there's a massive orgasm gap. You know that after that has happened time and time and time again,
you're not going to want to do it.
You don't want it. You don't want that. You definitely don't want that.
You'd rather secretly go upstairs, find your toy, make yourself happy. Good night.
Good night. You much rather the toy.
Yeah.
You know, men, we have to understand that this is happening. It's not about us. It is about we in this. And so that's also part of it. Part of it is tapping in. And what I would recommend.
Yes.
Is on the script, by the way, is it was Karen Gurney's book, Mind the Gap. My wife and I were reading it together.
Right.
Talking about it together. It's like when you do these things together, it opens up the opportunity to talk and discuss. Yes. Right. So absolutely incredibly important.
The other thing I'd like to say, I guess in same-sex marriages for women, I guess it would be the same thing, but I think intrinsically a woman would understand a woman and a woman's needs, but is that sometimes for women, foreplay is literally like cooking a meal together.
Yes.
In the evening, you get home, or asking how the day was, saying, would you like a glass of wine or shall I make you a cup of tea? That is foreplay, because if you've had an evening where you've not communicated at all, you get into bed and you go, right, let's, even if you're not saying let fancy shag, but the hand goes on the back, you think, I know what this means. I see that play out.
Yes.
So many times that actually the whole evening is foreplay. If you think that you want sex, like warm us up, you know, that's so important.
What I say is that foreplay begins the moment that sex is ended. That's really where it begins.
You are so right.
Because
for the next time, right?
For the next time, absolutely.
Yes, Paul.
This is it. This is it.
Oh my God, that is so good.
That's where it begins.
That's actually made me feel amazing. Like I just think that is actually it. How nice would that be for so many women if suddenly like the guys were behaving as if even if it was coming in 2 or 3 days' time, it's like, I'm going to start right now.
Yes. And then also the guys need to understand that there's benefits for us too.
Oh my God.
There are many.
Many.
It is endless benefits, you know.
For everyone.
Everyone
wants.
Why
wouldn't you?
Why would you not want to win? And this is why, and then you think about that, then that aspect of your life becomes so much better.
Yeah.
Then what happens? It's like a tide.
Yeah.
It everything rises.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's good.
I feel like you are in such a great place right now in your life. Please, can you you're launching your podcast.
Yes.
It will be launched by the time this goes out. So let's just say you've got your podcast. Please, can you just quickly tell everybody about it?
Absolutely. You know what's so wild is my set is just right here.
It's like we're in a family. We're part of the family. We're related.
We're related. We can throw a rock right to my set. But, you know, I am incredibly excited. I'm overwhelmed in my excitement around our podcast family. And my podcast is called We Need to Talk. And I'm doing this in essence and focusing around relationships. So those couples, for example, they could watch and they can watch together and dialogue and discuss.
I love this idea of couples sitting down to watch. So We Need to Talk.
Yes.
Also Find Love.
Find Love.
To help people navigate what is quite a tricky world of dating.
Absolutely. This book was about 10 years in the works,
making.
I'd say.
Yeah.
It is specifically for people who are searching for love, whether they are already in a relationship or not yet in a relationship.
I've just had the best time with you.
This was good.
Like, I love you.
I love you too.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing what you do.
I appreciate it. And I thank you for doing what you do. You are loved and adored.
Ditto.
And I think it's something that I hear the word national treasure. This is something I didn't hear until I came to the UK. National treasure. And I had this whole conversation with someone. I was like, what does it mean? What is it? Mm. What is it? And you know what they said? They said, you know, it's someone like Davina McCall.
That is so funny.
Yeah. Isn't that?
That is so weird.
Isn't that something?
Give me your hands. I love you.
Love you too.
Thank you.
Wow. Who doesn't love Paul Bronson? I mean, what an amazing.
You see how amazing it is for people to just spread love. Spread love, spread love is the what? The Vintook way. Ladies and gentlemen here, you guys must have coitus. You guys must have coitus. You guys are hearing here from experts. You guys must have coitus. Mm-hmm.
Amazing man. Such brilliant energy. Clearly practicing what he preaches, has a brilliant relationship with his wife, Jill. And I love the way that he's able to kind of share their experience to help all of us kind of have and navigate a better relationship. I think
the views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of
its Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the only person that does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa nora itatu natu bali o itatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So, ladies and gentlemen, one more conversation that we need to listen to is there's an author. His name is. Yeah, he's okay. There's an author that wrote a book called The Body Keeps Score, right? And today we are going to talk about, or we're going to listen to, how trauma shapes us. Eh? So we moved now from the marriage aspect, and now we're moving into trauma, and then we'll move into our last segment, and then we'll wrap it up.
In the preamble to the definition of PTSD, we write, these people have been exposed to an extraordinary event that is outside of normal human experience. So it turned out that this is not an unusual experience at all. The trauma is not the event that happens. The trauma is how you respond to it. The degree to which, when you're traumatized, your body keeps mobilizing itself to fight. You have all kind of immunological abnormalities. You have endocrine abnormalities. And that really devastate your health, your physical health, and the long range, oftentimes the physical problems are longer lasting than the mental problems. One of the largest mitigating factors against getting traumatized is who is there for you at that particular time. I did the first study on Prozac for PTSD, the first study for Zoloft for PTSD, and a number of other conventional drugs. What we found is that it didn't work very well. Hi, my name is Bessel van der Kolk. I'm a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, the author of the book, The Body Keeps Its Core.
Chapter 1, Trauma Explained.
I got interested in trauma on my first day working at the Veterans Administration. But the very first day that I met Vietnam veterans, I was just blown away. These were guys who were my age, who were clearly smart and competent and had done very good things, flying helicopters and running boats and doing good stuff in the military, and they clearly were just a shadow of their former self. And what particularly intrigued me is that they had nightmares about what had happened, and also that they kept referring back to their dead comrades. Their hearts seemed to be with the people who were no longer around, and what struck me immediately is they had a very hard time connecting with new people after the war. What also struck me is how their bodies were clearly affected by trauma. These were guys who used to be athletic, and now they were sort of slumped over, and they were uptight, and their voices were uptight, and they were sort of passive much of the time, and then people told them something that was disappointing, and they went from 0 to 10 and blew up and became extremely angry. And it was just at the time that we were having two small children who were a little bit like that. You know, they were little babies go from 0 to 10. But I know that when a baby becomes very upset, within 10 minutes you can sort of hold them and calm them down. And these soldiers were very much like little babies, except the stuff that's supposed to happen to allow you to not overreact to the minor things seemed to have been destroyed, or something seemed to have happened to that that made it very hard for them to modulate their responses to the environment. And what was also really striking is that they had a hard time being in any way meaningfully involved in the present. They had a hard time loving their wives and girlfriends. They had a hard time really connecting with their kids. So something seems to have been destroyed about their capacity to engage and possibly even to learn new experiences. 1978 was the year that I first saw veterans. And that was also the time that my colleagues, and I soon joined them, started to think about how is what these guys suffer from different from what other people who are in psychology textbooks, because clearly they were different, and I couldn't find a textbook to describe them. Around that time that I first started to work for the VA, a group of us started to define what trauma is and started to define what happens to people. In the preamble to the definition of PTSD, we write, these people have been exposed to an extraordinary event that is outside of normal human experience. And in retrospect, that shows us how ignorant and narrow-minded we were, because it turned out that this is not an unusual experience at all, that 1 out of 5 women in America has a history of sexual molestation. Even a lot of men have histories of sexual molestation. 1 out of 4 kids get beaten very hard by their parents. 1 out of 8 kids see physical fights between their parents. When we started to work with inner city kids, the amount of trauma that these kids experienced was just unspeakable. So somehow we had managed to turn a completely blind eye how what happens in people's environment creates the mind and creates who people become and creates certain forms of pathology. It was a real wake-up call. And there was a lot of debate of what a trauma is to this day. And even sometimes when I define it in the way we officially do, people still don't like what I say. But basically, what a trauma is something that happens to you that makes you so upset that it overwhelms you. It freaks you out, and you cannot, you just stand there or sit there or lie there or whatever, and you are at a loss what to do. You feel terrible, helpless, hopeless, and you collapse. Basically, there's an internal state of, oh my God. So it's not somebody being mean to you or nasty to you, or it is really bad stuff. But the trauma is not the event that happens. The trauma is how you respond to it. Let me give you an example. As a medical student, I was trained to deal with all kind of very difficult situations. And I remember vividly during my internship that a kid was brought in, a little child, with third-degree burn wounds all over his body. But I was trained as a medical student about what to do. So rather than freaking out, I thought, okay, I need to get my IV going, I need my fluids going. I focused on what to do. So that exposure to these horribly burned kids was not a trauma for me, because I was not paralyzed in my actions, because I had been trained to deal with it. And of course, that happens to policemen, that happens to people in the service, it happens to physicians, nurses, etc., is that you get trained on what to do and not to get overwhelmed by your feelings, but to actually be able to continue to act and do something. And when you're traumatized, you just are unable to do anything. It's a subjective experience, and what may be traumatic for you may not be traumatic for me, vice versa, depending on our personality and our training. An event becomes traumatic if your response is, oh my God, and when there is nothing you can think of you can do to stave off the inevitable, where you basically collapse in a state of confusion, maybe rage, maybe collapse, because you are unable to function in the face of this particular threat. An event like that may not become a trauma in the long range if at the moment that you collapse, other people around you come over and say, oh, I see that you're really in bad shape. Let me help you. Let me take over for you and do things that you cannot do yourself. And so the greatest protector against the trauma is the people around you, whether they're able to protect you and to do what needs to be done, or whether the people around you actually make it worse by continuing to do terrible things to you or blaming you for your responses. Trauma is actually, unlike what we first thought, extremely common. At least one out of 8 kids in America witness physical violence between their parents. A larger number of kids get hit in very nasty ways by their own caregivers. A very large number of people in general, but women in particular, have sexual experiences that were clearly unwanted and that left them helpless and befuddled, confused and enraged because they had no choice about what they were doing. These experiences are extremely common. So people usually think about the military when they talk about trauma, but I like to say, somewhat unscientifically, that for every soldier who gets PTSD in a war zone, there's at least 30 children who get traumatized at home. The nature of trauma is that an experience enters into your ears, into your skin, into your eyes, into sensations, and it goes down into a very primitive part of your brain that automatically interprets what is going on. That's not your frontal lobe. But your frontal lobe, your conscious cognitive self, that is a later issue. The first thing is a somatic response. So something happens to you, your survival brain makes the first interpretation and says, is this dangerous or is this safe? That decision is made for you by that primitive survival brain. And that's what we learned a lot about when we study trauma, is the power of that primitive brain, which occupies a very large part of our brain, that really automatically makes decisions for us. And on the basis of the messages we get from our body, our cognition interprets in a particular way, depending on our prior experiences. But the message comes from our hormones and our physiological impulses that have to do with survival. We're talking about staying alive. And so when you're being raped or you're being beaten, or you see your parents getting killed, your body starts automatically going into a state trying to make yourself survive. One of the states is going into fight flight, to get up and to punch people and to become very angry. And that's oftentimes when people are traumatized, the fight flight responses continue to get activated in response to situations where people in their environment says, hey, hey, cool it, this is not so bad. But people have these automatic responses. Or on a more primitive level even, is that people's brain shuts down and they lose track of themselves and they basically make themselves disappear, very much like animals can do that also in the wild. They can sort of collapse and play possum, as it were. And playing possum is exactly what happens to people also. And when you beat a kid enough, that kid starts collapsing and no longer response to its environment. So it is either fight flight or collapse, none of which have anything to do with cognition. And doing cognitive therapy with that is really a misunderstanding of what happens with traumatized people. They have automatic responses, and they don't have these responses because they're stupid or because they don't understand what's going on. Most people actually do understand that their reactions are completely out of whack. They don't need to be told that. But because they react in such an extreme way, they feel deeply ashamed about themselves because they say to themselves, I'm a nutcake. I screamed at people. I collapsed when I had to stand up for myself. And so you have these automatic responses that are not a product of your cognitive assessment. They're a product of your animal brain trying to stay alive in the face of something that that part of your brain interprets as a life threat. Even though the people around you by now got, this is not a life threat at all. We come into the world being able to do what little babies can do. And what can little babies do? They can breathe. They can sleep. They can suck. They can feel hungry. They can poop. They can pee. They can cry. And that's about it. So we call that the housekeeping of the body. Little babies already can do that. And little babies, their system get very activated, so babies will scream and they'll cry and they'll look catastrophic. And then the people around them pick them up and soothe them and calm that part of the brain down. Much of the imprint of trauma is in that very primitive survival part of your brain that's already in place in little babies. In fact, what the research recently has been showing, there's a little area way the base of your skull, periaqueductal gray, that I like to call the cockroach brain. There's a part of you that just picks up what's dangerous and what's safe. And now it turns out that when you're traumatized, that little part of your brain, which is usually very quiet for most of us, continues to just send messages to you when you're traumatized. And so there's always this sort of message you get from deep down inside of your body of, I'm in danger, I'm not safe. So you're always uptight, always on alert, and you spend much of your energy trying to suppress those feelings of fear in order to not to embarrass yourself, in order to be able to work with what you do. And so it's very primitive. And then on top of that middle of the primitive part of your brain, you develop a limbic system, and your limbic system basically creates an internal map of the world that tells you what out there is safe, what is dangerous. So if you say to me, boy, after this interview is over, let's go to the Star and plow down the street and have a nice lager beer, I go like, wow, that's so cool, because I love that bar, and I don't love that bar. So already in my internal mind, I have a map of what is safe and what's dangerous. And that map is created by the experiences we have. And so the brain is a use-dependent organ. And the brain gets formed on the basis of the experiences that we have, particularly in the first few years of your life. And so if you're a little kid and you grow up in very safe surroundings and people are delighted to see you and people say, isn't she cute? Isn't she wonderful? You grow up with a sense of, I'm so cute. And people love me, because that becomes the map of your world. That's how people respond to you. And that basically that stays with you for much of the rest of your life. If you're a little kid and people say to you, as I hear all the time, I wish you hadn't been born. I tried to abort you, but I fail. You just really ruined my life. You just have always been a pain in the ass. That becomes your map of the world. And a little kid doesn't say, when you're 3 years old or 5 years old, Mom, you're crazy saying that about me, because a little kid doesn't have other ways of looking at the world. So the world that you live in is the only world that there is. And if you're being treated as a difficult, unpleasant person, that becomes your perception of yourself. I'm fundamentally a bad, a defective person. And that people's cognition does not make that go away. People can tell you till you're blue in the face, oh, you're wonderful, you're terrific. I've known a whole bunch of people like that who were very abused and neglected as kids, who have become amazing musicians, artists, athletes. The world adores them, and deep inside, they still feel like crap, that they're defective people, because that imprint stays with them. My colleagues and I started to look at these traumatized soldiers primarily. We actually went back over what had been written before. The library at the VA I was working didn't have a single book about war trauma, war neurosis, any of these things. But so I went down to the old Harvard Medical Library, and I dug up a book that was written in 1941 by a guy by the name of Abram Gardner, who had been working with First World War soldiers. And he writes about his First World War soldiers back a long time ago. He writes, these guys suffer from a physioneurosis. Their bodies continue to re-experience the trauma. And he says, and the trauma keeps coming back, keeps revisiting them in the form of nightmares and flashbacks. They keep reliving what happened back there. They cannot leave it behind. And the trauma keeps coming back either as images or as behaviors. As the people behave again as if they are getting raped or getting assaulted, even though they are not getting raped or getting assaulted. So, but we defined, but people had seen that before us, all the way back to well over 100 years, at the core of trauma is that you get stuck. And that event keeps coming back in terms of images, behaviors, and physical sensations. So that became at the core of our definition of PTSD. The second piece is that having been constantly bombarded with this horrifying stuff makes you preoccupied with how do I go on with my life? And so you work very hard on avoiding things that make you lose your senses. And so people avoid and people suppress it and people actually learn to not feel things in their bodies and they stifle internal sensations, internal feelings. So that's the second piece is on the one side, it's this fight-flight keeps going on. The other thing is you calm yourself down. You try to suppress yourself. You try not to feel. And so at the end, you don't feel very alive. And the third thing is that you continue to be hyper-aroused. You know, you just keep being bombarded. You keep overreacting to all kinds of things in general. That's the original definition of PTSD. And that is still the definition as you find in a textbook still, but what we discovered is that the whole impact of trauma is much larger, and it also affects the way you feel about yourself, the way you feel about other people, the way you are able to notice yourself, the way you experience yourself, and it has a lot of self-distortions and distortions of your body also. And then over time, we again rediscovered something because these things always have been noted before. The degree to which when you're traumatized, your body keeps mobilizing itself to fight, and that you have all kind of immunological abnormalities, you have endocrine abnormalities, and that really devastates your health, your physical health. At the long range, oftentimes the physical problems are longer lasting than the mental problems. The other thing that we discovered, which is still an area of some controversy in the field, not for me, but for my colleagues who are in power, is that trauma affects the mind and the brain very differently depending on the age at which you are. And so if something terrible happens to me right now, I have a whole well-developed brain, and my brain isn't really growing all that much anymore, so I'll get an imprint of the trauma that is pretty much superimposed on a relatively well-functioning brain. If you're 2, 3, or 4 years old, your mind and your brain is growing. What various of my research friends have shown is that trauma at different ages affects different ways of wiring the brain, and it gets very complex, as like my friend Marty Teicher has really shown that trauma at age 3 changes the brain very differently than trauma at age 5, at trauma at age 14, and that the brain keeps growing and evolving, and so different events have a different imprint of the brain. That's one aspect. And the other thing that is terribly important is not only what's happening to you, but what's happening to your environment. And by and large, as I said before, if you are really freaked out as a kid and your parents are there for you and they smile at you and say, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it, honey. I know what to do. Or you have a doctor who really knows what they're doing, who you can trust. You go like, okay, I can relax now, because even if I can't take care of it, other people can take care of it for me. One of the largest mitigating factors against getting traumatized is who is there for you at that particular time. When you feel constantly threatened, of course, you don't trust anybody. But there is a reason to not trust people. The tradition in mental health is to dismiss people, the reality of people's lives. For example, it's only in the past few years that people are beginning to talk about the impact of poverty or the impact of racism or the impact of unemployment. And people have sort of been labeling people, oh, there's something wrong with you, let me fix you. But mental health professionals have been very defective in helping people to really come to terms with what actually has happened to them and what's happening to them right now. So a good amount of distrust is very well justified. And very likely today, if you're a traumatized person, you don't go to a doctor and say, I was raped when I was 4 years old and that's why I come to be treated. No, people go come to be treated because today you blow up at your husband. And today you cannot have a safe, satisfactory sexual relationship with your new partner. And that's why people coming into treatment, because the body automatically reacts to certain stimuli. And most people actually are barely aware or not aware at all that their reactions that they're having right now are actually are rooted in experience that they've had before. So if you go to a physician or a mental health practitioner who doesn't understand that, they're going to try to fix you with drugs or cognitive behavioral treatment to not do these crazy things anymore. It usually doesn't work very well because you need to really develop a deep sense of this is what happened to me. This is what I'm dealing with. And you need to really acknowledge like, oh my God, that was terrible what happened to me. And I need to take care of the wounds that I'm carrying inside of myself. This issue of self-compassion and really knowing that your reactions are understandable and are rooted in you getting stuck in the past is a terribly important part of beginning to recover from trauma. And as long as you ignore that, you're just a crazy person who has crazy reactions. The problem with trauma is that it starts off with something that happens to us or that's done to us. But that's not where it stops, because it changes your brain. And from now, that event itself is over, but you continue to react to things as if you're in danger. And your brain actually gets changed in a variety of different ways. And the problem then becomes that you are not able to engage or to learn or to see other people's point of view or to coordinate your feelings with your thinking. And so yet it becomes an internal issue how the trauma continues to fester inside of you in a variety of different sensations and perceptions. Yes, there is something wrong with you. But people don't come to see me because of what happened to them. People come to see me because they feel there is something really wrong with me. I cannot connect with my kids. I become angry with all my coworkers. Nobody can stand being around me because I am so reactive. Yes, trauma causes that there is something wrong with you. And my job as a psychiatrist and all the colleagues and students I have is to help you to feel safe in your body and to feel like the trauma is over and that you don't continue to react to all kind of things now as if somebody is trying to hit you or rape you. I think the most important thing to know is that there's a difference between trauma and stress. As I like to say to people, life sucks a good amount of the time. Now, we all have jobs and situations that are really unpleasant. But the moment that a situation is over, it's over. And you go on with your life. A trauma happens, and when it's over, your body continues to relive it. And the core issue is that your body does it. Your endocrine system, your neurohormonal system, the immunological system continues to react as if you're back there. So there is something about the development of the mind that gets stopped at that point because the trauma cannot be integrated as, oh yeah, that really sucked, but it's over now. Trauma makes you think that it's still happening right now. So the big challenge of treating trauma is how do we help people to live in bodies that feel fundamentally safe? where something unpleasant happens to you, you don't react as if you're like, is in danger, but you go like, oh, how do I solve this? But when you're traumatized, but it's very striking in a whole variety of different brain studies, what you show is that when you show a non-traumatized person something ambiguous and difficult, their cognitive brain tries to figure out what's going on. When you show this same stimulus to people who are traumatized, the emotional brain reacts like, is this dangerous or is this safe? Your brain goes into, is my life in danger? And that's an emotional reaction. What lights up in the brain is a very different part of the brain, but then when you have to solve a problem. So you're continuously trying to manage your emotional reactions.
Chapter 2, Shaping Childhood Trauma.
People have always noticed that people relive their trauma, but as I said before, usually people are not aware of it. Kids are not aware of that they're reliving their having been beaten or witnessing domestic violence, and when they go to school, they react in a very angry and defiant way with their teachers, say, oh, this reminds me about my mom and dad fighting, making me scared. No, they have an automatic reaction to adults who sound in any way not okay to blow up and become very frightened. So they don't make the connection. And so what happened when we created this diagnosis of PTSD, you know, we weren't very perceptive. You know, we were just beginning to see something for the first time. And the most obvious thing in which people relive the trauma is in nightmares. In nightmares, people see it again, or they experience the event in their dreams. That is the most obvious, and we could see it. It took us a long time to realize that people also are continue to reenact the trauma in their relationships, that they may relate to their kid the same way they related to people who hurt them as little children. And so they don't make that connection. But what allows you to make the connection is when you actually have images of what happened back there. But most people don't have visual images. Most people have sensory reactions. They suddenly feel uptight. They feel nervous, panicky, anxious, enraged. They don't know where it's come from. After they read books like mine, they know at least where it comes from. It comes from some part of your brain that you actually cannot really know because it's beyond cognition. So, oh, that's why I'm doing that stuff. That's sort of helpful to know. But most people who are reenacting or replaying the trauma are not aware that they're recreating or replaying the trauma. So trauma affects the developing brain different from a well-developed brain. The research is really very interesting, intriguing about this, and that's the degree to which parents hold and modulate kids' traumatic responses. As I said before, when as a kid you get bitten by a dog, it's really very scary and very nasty. But if your parents pick you up and say, oh, I'm so sorry, let's go and take care of it, and let's give you a bath, and we'll give you some extra special food, that dog bite doesn't become a big issue because the foundation of your safety has not been destroyed. A study I like to quote, actually, and teach people about, is a study that was done in London right after the Second World War, because London was being bombed by the Nazis. The Brits decided, let's send the kids in London who are being bombed out to the bucolic English countryside to live with very nice people, and when the war is over, they'll come back, and they won't have seen all these dead people and dead corpses and all the bombing. They'll be much better off. And so, after the war, Anna Freud, of all people, Sigmund Freud's daughter, and her friend Dorothy Burlingame, did a study of what happened to these kids. It turned out that the kids who stayed in London with their parents did just fine, because the safety of kids is determined by how safe they feel with their parents. While the kids who went to the countryside, like Oliver Sacks, who some of your listeners may also be a great fan of like I am, he was shipped to the countryside, and in his autobiography, Oliver Sacks writes that one of the two most traumatic events in my life was being shipped off to the countryside, and I was a really scared and upset kid who was primarily preoccupied with whether my parents are still alive, but I didn't see them anymore. What trauma also has really taught us is the degree to which we are profoundly interconnected and interdependent people, and we are relational creatures. And as long as our relationships are intact, by and large, we're pretty good with trauma. Who knows that? The U.S. Marine Corps and the Armed Services, they take a bunch of people who are obviously, who sometimes escape their own horrible child environments and join the military, and they go into the military. And what does the military do for them? They create a sense of cohesion, a sense of predictability, a sense of safety. And so through all these exercises that you do in the army, you feel very connected with your group. And when you go to war with your group, you feel very safe that your buddies are there to protect you, and that really protects you against getting traumatized. And the very first study I did before we knew anything about trauma was the discovery that the PTSD started for many soldiers when they saw their best friend being blown up, because they really had a sense of safety and cohesion because they had a friend, but then that friend got killed, the whole world collapsed, and they no longer had the safety that came with the group. And so what you see with many traumatized people is that they continue to really pull towards reconnecting with people who have had similar experiences, because when you say, I was raped, and I was raped too, you go like, you know what I'm talking about. You're special. I can be safe with you, as opposed to all these people who have no idea what I'm talking about. The lingering effect of childhood trauma is that you continue to react to mild stressors as if your life is in danger. You tend to become hyperreactive. People see your reactions as exaggerated. Somebody may irritate you in the supermarket and may yell at this person. You may develop road rage. You may have a difficult time putting up with misbehavior from your spouse or your kids, and you have exaggerated emotional responses. The other thing is, it oftentimes is very hard to negotiate intimate relationships. Negotiating both of our needs, your needs and my needs, actually, is a very complex phenomenon. How do we make compromises? How do we make both of us happy at the same time? And when you have a childhood trauma, that oftentimes becomes very difficult. Very difficult to say, okay, honey, if that's what you need, I wouldn't want to do that, but I'm fine with you if you do that. And these issues of boundaries and who's responsible for what becomes a very hard thing to negotiate oftentimes. The big question for me continues to be, how do you help kids in particular who have been exposed to enormous amount of violence, life threats, people who don't pay attention to them? How do you help these kids get a sense of self, a sense of agency, so they can actually make a life for themselves where they can learn, acquire skills, acquire competencies, so they become full-fledged human beings? What the data show is that the long-term effects of child abuse and neglect, which is rampant in our country, is the biggest public health issue in America. Let me give you an example. There is other societies that are much more trauma-savvy than we are, where there is not an enormous amount of income inequality, where parents actually are helped to take care of their kids, where healthcare is universal, where childcare is universal. One of these places is Holland, which happens to be my native country, which I left when I was 18 years old, and which has become a very nice place. So in a culture like that, that really looks at what are the antecedents for getting people to be dysfunctional, they do all these things to help people to take care of their kids. And so in the Netherlands right now, the incarceration rate is 58 per 100,000 people. In the U.S., it's 950 per 100,000 people. So the big issue is a political issue. How do we rearrange our society to really know about trauma and to really do all the things that are necessary so that people who grow up under extreme adverse conditions can develop a brain and a mind that can help them to become full-fledged members of society instead of on the edge as drug addicts and disabled people or people who need to go to jail? That's our big issue, and that's the big challenge that we have.
Chapter 3. How to Treat Trauma.
I was raised in the mainstream culture as a professor at prestigious institutions. And what's mainstream culture, the culture we live in, is that when you feel bad, you take a swig of alcohol or you take a swig of something to make that feeling go away. I call our medical culture right now a post-alcoholic culture, where if you feel bad, you take something to make that feeling go away. And it turned out that taking something didn't make the feelings go away, but wiggling your fingers in front of people's eyes as they think about the trauma made the trauma go away. And I go like, wow, this is really interesting. When I first got to see trauma and got intrigued with it, I looked at the treatments that we have. And so I did the first study on Prozac for PTSD, the first study for Zoloft for PTSD, and a number of other conventional drugs. What we found is that it didn't work very well. And we published those data in prestigious medical journals, and people said, boy, Wendell Koch is a great psychopharmacology researcher. But our results showed that they don't work very well. Somehow, psychiatry never got the message and said, no, drugs are not particularly helpful. And the VA still spends billions of dollars on drugs that don't work. They were unable to go through the trajectory that I and most of my colleagues went through, like, okay, if it doesn't work, let's do see what else can work. And people over ask me, how can you put up with all this misery that you hear? And I agree, it's not easy. But one of the things that helps you is to really understand that people do the best they can. That somebody who's enraged in response to a minor thing is not becoming enraged because they just are unpleasant, difficult people who don't try. No, they try. People try to survive. Every person tries to have the best possible life they can have. And sometimes it goes really wrong. But for example, when you're a little kid and you don't feel like anybody's there to help you when you become distressed, you may learn that banging your head against the wall, or stabbing yourself, or burning yourself, or starving yourself may make you feel better. And so what you discover is that people do all kinds of things that seem pretty weird sometimes on the surface to protect themselves. There was a moment in sort of the history of our field that was particularly poignant in this regard. Vince Valletti, who is the internist who did the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, had a very important experience that he shared with all of us, which makes perfect sense to me. He had a weight loss program, and that's all he did. He was very proud of his weight loss program, and then one day a woman came to his office who had lost something like 150 pounds or something in the course of the weight loss program, and she came back 3 months later, and she had regained almost all of her weight. He said, I didn't know people could gain so much weight in such a short period. What happened to you? And she says, you know, Dr. Fillet, your weight loss program was terrific. And I became swelled, and people's reaction to me completely changed. So after my last visit to you, where you complimented me about how well I was doing, I went back to my office, and one of my coworkers said, boy, you look really hot. Would you like to go on a date tonight? And the moment he said that, I started to eat. And I haven't stopped eating, because what I realized is overweight is overlooked. And the way I dealt with my childhood sexual abuse is to make myself grossly obese so nobody would have an interest in me in a sexual way. So that was one of these openings, and you get to see that some of the behaviors that we may condemn or be upset about actually are behaviors that start off trying to take care of yourself. That actually is also true for drug abuse. People say, it's a biological illness, but it's not so simple. But, you know, if I say to you right now, oh, I have a little needle with some heroin in it, makes you feel good, would you like to try it? You'd say, you're crazy. I'm not going to take heroin. But if you are in despair and you don't know if you're going to make it through the night, and I say, I have a little drug here that can help you make it through the night, you go like, please, please give it to me. That's where drug addiction comes from. That's also, to a large degree, where our opioid epidemic comes from. It's also the stuff being made available to people. But, you know, among my colleagues who are, you know, have privileged lives, they don't become drug addicts because they have good lives. They don't need to cure something in terms of how upset they are. But since time immemorial, people take drugs in order to deal with unbearable sensations. The military had a huge drug problem during the Vietnam War because people take these drugs in order not to feel their pain. If we really want to take care of drug abuse, we really have to look at social situations and circumstances that make people feel desperate and hopeless. Very good psychotherapy, not to fix people, but helping people to know what they're feeling, find ways in which to cope with those feelings, was really quite helpful. What was very clear is that being in a relationship where people can hear you, where you can talk about how badly you feel, where you can talk about your guilt, and where you can start opening up where these feelings come from, how old these feelings are, and how you develop these feelings in response to particular things that happened to you, that was actually quite helpful. Finding words for your internal experience, which is oftentimes very difficult for traumatized people. They actually have impairment of being able to know themselves, being able to discover who they are and how they got these reactions is very helpful. And then for me, the opening to a new world came when some people in my clinic started to do something very strange, something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, a technique where you ask people to call up the memory of what you saw back then, what you heard back then, what you felt back then, but you don't ask people to talk about it. Because the moment you start talking about something, you get more preoccupied whether the person you're talking to understands you, likes you, is disgusted with you. So it becomes an interpersonal process. This, you ask people to just feel it and notice it. And then what you do is that you ask people to follow your fingers as you move your fingers from side to side in front of their eyes. And my first reaction with my students and junior colleagues who do it is like, man, stop this crazy nonsense. This is a crazy method. And then I got to see some of the results. I go like, wow, this is interesting. This is different. And so I did a study funded by NIH, funded because people saw me as a very good psychopharmacologist, not a guy who had gone off the deep end doing crazy methods like EMDR. And everybody expected that we'd find that the drugs are much better than EMDR. And what we found is that this crazy eye movement desensitization had amazing effects on people being able to let go of what happened and say, yes, that's what happened to me, and it happened a long time ago. It's not happening right now. That was the first time that I saw a non-conventional technique have a very profound effect. And that really had a very deep effect on my thinking about treatment of trauma. And of course, my colleague said, Bessel has gone off the deep end. The data on EMDR was still better than any data of the treatment.
Unbeatable prices now at USave. Pay only $134.99 Namibian dollars for Lovie's premium disposable nappies. Pay just $6.99 for 8 Nina sanitary pads. $34.99 Namibian dollars for 250 grams of Fabu Farm body cream. 1 kilo bag of Sunlight 5-in-1 washing powder costs only $29.99 Namibian dollars at USave. And both 500 milliliter New Den Pine Gel and 750 milliliter Captain Dishwashing Liquid just $19.99 Namibian dollars. USave. We all save at USave.
Outcome that anybody had studied, but people didn't want to go there because it's such a crazy method. So I tried to get money to study what those eye movements do to the brain. It took us about 15 years to collect money from other sources to finally do that study, where we were able to show that you move your eyes from side to side, that you actually change brain circuits, that changes the executive function of the brain, the default mode network of the brain, and the salience network of the brain. So what we discovered with all the other things that happened in neuroscience is that these strange eye movements that sound so bizarre actually change the circuitry of the brain to interpret your current reality from a different angle. But the discovery at this point is that our conventional way of thinking about it is not working, but strange stuff works. And then a bunch of yoga teachers come to talk to me and say, we do yoga for PTSD and it seems to help people. And that made sense to me on some level. Maybe if you do yoga, you really, yoga can open up your relationship to your body, to your physical self. You learn how to breathe calmly. You learn to pay attention to yourself. You get to see how different movements and different postures affect you. And so you form a deep relationship to your internal sensory system. Trauma is carried in the sensations in your body, in heartbreak and gut wrench. And that we have been able to see in the brain is that your connection with your body becomes weaker and weaker, so you don't feel your body anymore, so you don't feel your pain anymore. Problem is that if you don't feel your pain anymore, you don't feel your pleasure anymore either. I was reading an extraordinary case report of somebody who lost all sensations in their skin, in their bodies. And it's a very, very rare thing to happen to people. And what people discovered is if you cannot have a sensation in your skin, you cannot have a sensation of pleasure. A sensation of pleasure is carried by the corpuscles in our skin. So we need to get pleasurable sensations coming from our body to get a sense of pleasure and joy. And that's what's really interesting to me also, because traumatized people, and that's left out of the definition, have a tremendous problem experiencing pleasure and joy. We applied a number of times to study that, and at the end we did get funded to the very first yoga study for PTSD. And what turned out is that the way the data looked to me, yoga at the end was a more effective treatment for PTSD than any of the drugs we had studied. And we did a number of yoga studies. We published them in respected medical journals, but I've yet to see a psychopharmacology clinic being transformed to a yoga studio, even though it's pretty clear that needing to feel safe in your body and to own your body and to feel all the sensations in your body is a critical aspect of healing from PTSD. The next thing that we studied was theater and movement. And it turns out that playing different roles in your body helps you to feel that your body can feel differently depending on how you organize your relationship to yourself. So I live in the Berkshires, and we have a great program here called Shakespeare in the Courts, where if you're a juvenile delinquent in this county, you have a 50% chance that the judge will condemn you to become a Shakespearean actor. That's civilization. Huh? And the Shakespeare program is enormously helpful because it helps people to feel their bodies and to feel what it feels like to be a king and to feel like to be a warrior and to feel what it feels like to be Ophelia. And you get to really have a deep experience of yourself in different possibilities. We learned that you can actually put electrodes on your skull and you can harvest your brain waves and project them on a computer screen, and then you can program the computer screen so that when you make brainwaves that help you to be calm and focused, so the computer game is working, and if your brain makes waves that don't do that, there's no computer game. So your brain wants to play the computer game, but the moment you develop brainwaves that are not helpful to you, the screen goes blank. So that your brain sort of wants to do the right thing, and you can actually train people to make the right brainwaves. And that's another piece of research that I feel very proud of, because it's very hard to find funding for it, that we really showed that we can change people's brain and brain connections by playing computer brains, games with your own brain, which is another important project that I'm working on and trying to implement in various communities. And also I did a study of foster care children who are extremely out of control kids who have no prognosis to probably ever function very well because they're just too disorganized and too hurt. And we did very well with neurofeedback to help them calm their brains down and to learn and to be in classrooms and to have friends. So there's all these things that at this point are still called alternatives that unless we go there, our patients continue to get stuck on not getting better. You have to keep looking. about 15 years ago, two guys came to talk to me, Vic Doblin and Michael Mithoffer, and they said, Bessel, you know a lot about trauma. What do you think about this idea? We are thinking about psychedelics. What do you think about psychedelics for trauma? And I go like, wow, that you're speaking from my heart. Because, of course, I'm a child of the 60s. And like everybody else who I know who grew up with me, we dabbled in LSD and psychedelic substances. I have a number of friends who are very well-known scientists, actually. And I asked my, have asked all of my friends, did you drop acid as a college student also? And every one of my friends said, sure did. And I said, so what do you how do you think it has affected your career? And every one of my friends says, you know, I think I've become the creative scientist that I am because I took these substances, because it allowed me to see that the reality that I was raised in, that the reality that I see, is a very small part overall reality that there is. Those sort of answers make me feel very curious, because one thing that all of us who know about trauma know is that when you get traumatized, you start living in a very narrow reality. The reality of the war in Iraq, the reality of your incest, that colors everything you do. And so you become intellectually and emotionally quite a constricted person, because you are always afraid to get hurt, and you still feel like, I'm about to get hurt again. So that becomes your world. I said to them, wouldn't it be great if we could do psychedelic substances to see if these substances can open up people's minds and to see that the reality that they live in is just a small part of the reality that there is. And then I said, don't do it. You're crazy. These drugs are illegal. I knew a whole bunch of people who did LSD and psilocybin research back when I was young. It helps to be around a little bit, because I saw that revolution back then. I had Timothy Leary's office at Harvard for a period of time. I know what happened to all these guys. I said to Rick and Michael, don't do it. It will destroy your career. You'll never get permission. And they said, thank you very much for your opinion. We'll try it anyway. And they tried anyway. And through great challenges and lawsuits, etc., they got permission to do a study of MDMA for trauma. And it worked out pretty well. And they got permission to do a second study again. Very hard to do. And they did very well. And then Rick Doblin was able to collect a large amount of money, largely from Silicon Valley people, to do a very large and extremely expensive study of MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly. When that happened, they asked me if I wanted to be the principal investigator of one of the sites in Boston. And I said, boy, I admire you so much for having been able to get a study of the ground. I would love to see what it does. But the main reason why I want to be involved in the study is to warn people not to get carried away, because last time people got carried away and the whole world collapsed. And this time we need to be extremely careful, so that if we find something, we do it very carefully and we don't get the backlash. We did a study. Lots of different sites around the U.S., one in Israel, one in Canada. We saw remarkable results. The paper was published in Nature Medicine, a very prestigious medical journal, that shows that the MDMA causes a very, very substantial drop in PTSD, probably more than just about anything else we have studied, although I'm not 100% sure of that, but very dramatic. And then what comes up for me is, yeah, you know, the PTSD score is interesting, but what we see in the people we work with is much more profound than just PTSD. So let me tell you how the study is set up. People apply to be in the study. It's a very tough study to be in. It takes about 9 months to do it. You come in, you get tested up the wazoo, you go off all your medications, you do a lot of tests, you have a number of preparatory sessions, and then finally, after all the preparation, you have a whole day of taking ecstasy while you lie on the bed, the eye shade, the two therapists in your room for 8 hours, and then stuff happens, which I'll talk about in a second. You sort of calm down from the experience. You stay overnight. The next day, we interview people again. We interview people several times in between. You have your next experience. A month later, number of sessions in between, and you have your next experience again. It's not surprising that our control group, where people get an inactive substance, also do very well because people get very intensive psychotherapy alongside of the drug. So half people get the drug, half people don't get the drug. But what we see in the people who get the drug is amazing. What we see is that people are able to go to places they have never felt safe to go to. This is not a picnic. People go and see their rape. They see their molestation. They see the horrible things that happened to them. But what MDMA does, it allows people to see themselves with compassion. And rather than blaming themselves or getting freaked out, they go like, oh yeah, that's what happened to me back then. It was horrible. But what we see is a profound transformation of the personality, not just PTSD. And so I was very lucky that the organization asked me to analyze what is called the secondary data, which I'm doing right now. And the secondary data are, wow, they're just manna for my soul. It's like, because it brings the mind back into psychiatry. After people take MDMA, they're able to talk about themselves. They're able to have compassion for themselves. They're much better able to say, this is what's going on with me. And so all these measures we have about self-perception and self-awareness just shoot up, and people become owners of their own lives. And they're able to say, yes, this is what happened to me, but it's over. And then we look at the whole issue of executive functioning, being able to make plans, being able to attune to other people, being able to feel alive. Big changes. People could come to life. And when people are in difficult relationships, they say, honey, that's your problem. That's not my problem. And people sometimes leave abusive relationship and they say, I don't need this abusive relationship. I'm okay. I can take care of myself. And you see very profound existential transformations in people. And I think that's really, at the end, holds the promise that people can leave the trauma behind and not say, I'm a veteran who still screwed up. Yes, I was a veteran back then. I was 18 years old. But today, I'm 23 years old or 48 years old or 60. And I'm a plumber, an electrician, a movie maker, whatever. And that's part of my experience. But it doesn't define who I am anymore. It's remarkable.
Wonderful how trauma does not define you. Ladies and gentlemen, it's such a wonderful time to be alive, and we'll keep spreading the message of love. So, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is a wonderful Thursday evening. The time is approximately almost 11 o'clock, and it is in the night, okay? So don't be waking up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my goodness, it's 11 o'clock in the afternoon because my blinds are on or closed or my curtains are dark. No. It's nighttime, okay? And tonight we are hearing what the experts have to say about certain things, and how we can digest that is by attentively listening and comprehending what is being said. So please feel free to call in and have a conversation about what you have heard and how you see it and how you view it, and let's take it from there. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle FM do not claim any ownership of the clips that we are playing here this evening. We are strictly using it for information purposes and for a thought digest, huh? We are using it to stimulate and open the school of thought for you to dabber. So the first conversation was, coitus during marriage and why it is so important. And then the second one was how to truly heal from trauma with the body keeping score, and the trauma does not define you. And the next one is Why did you stay with a narcissist? Now, the concept of a narcissist has been thrown around ever so often in our society, especially with our woke generation, our insightful generation, our self-care generation, our self-awareness generation, and our self-involved, and also our generation that is really honestly seeking and sorting out for help and for assistance to somehow manage and work through their mental health crises or the issues that they've had in their lives, where we are honestly just trying to be better people and better citizens and better everythings, right? And we are trying our level best to be the better part of ourselves. And we are getting awakening. We're having a rude awakening that is happening as we speak, as we indulge in the works of renowned psychologists, renowned psychiatrists, renowned doctors, renowned neuroscientists, renowned mathematicians, renowned. It keeps going. So we are honestly just emerging, and we are coming out. We are coming out to the top, and we are winning. Okay.
That idea of not seeing what is happening in the relationship happens not because you are in denial, not because you are dumb, not because you're a codependent, but because there is a cost to seeing the bad things happening in the relationship. Something I hear all the time from people is, I know I need to leave this relationship, but the good stuff makes it hard to leave. Or, now that this relationship is over, it's so hard, I miss the good stuff. When I hear that, I'm curious about what this good stuff was. And the stuff that is shared about the so-called good stuff that a person misses, or that would make it hard to leave a toxic relationship, it's often stuff that actually isn't all that good. Or it's actually sort of an intoxicating dynamic that isn't so good. But folks said the good was a sort of waiting and wondering and a sense that maybe this time it could be different, right? Lots of people get stuck in narcissistic relationships, or actually even originally get into them because of the so-called good things that are on display. These good things may be stuff or actions or whatever, words that convinced you into the relationship, even in the early days when you might have had that spidey sense that something wasn't quite right. The good things, whatever those were to you, may have blurred your vision or even kept you stuck long after the relationship became quite toxic. Your good thing is not someone else's good thing. Sure, there are some universals, but even those, for example, even attractiveness isn't always universal. For example, folks would say, and I've heard people say, it feels uncomfortable to be in a relationship with someone who's judged to be too attractive, because it sort of brings up insecurities and things, right? You may love dogs and someone else doesn't like them at all. So a partner with lots of dogs might be very attractive to one person, not at all attractive to someone else. But that stuff is all superficial stuff. As we dig deeper, it may be stuff like that. That's the good stuff, is like being really organized or being really responsible or being really disciplined or being really outgoing or being serious or sharing emotions readily. It could be things that wouldn't register to other people as good. Again, we're all different, so the things that are good might feel different. And then there is the stuff that gets you stuck, that nobody would likely think is good. For example, someone who always feels just a bit slippery or just out of reach, and that the good thing is the game of it all and having to win them over. I mean, that's exhausting. But for people who have it, it's often an old wound, and a wound that can keep you on the hook. The breakup makeup cycle, it can feel very ancient. And you may have even had the experience of relationships where your relationship almost felt easy. The other person didn't feel slippery at all. They were open. They were available. They were responsive. And some people sometimes judge relationships like that as uninteresting or not intimate or romantic. So these things, whatever these things are that are good, that keep a person stuck in a narcissistic relationship, have backstories. Now, some of the backstories are not that interesting and may merely be a byproduct of what society tells us we are supposed to want or value, stuff like money, appearance, credentials. But others, these are personal to you. In fact, some people wouldn't find them good at all or even downright ick. But the narcissistic relationship's good in your book comes from something far deeper. And these good things matter because they may have been what made the relationship hard to leave or provided the substantiation for the justifications. For example, a person in a relationship who is very financially careful, saves their money, lives according to a strict budget, that may not be a good thing necessarily to everyone, but the backstory on that may be that you grew up with selfish, immature, financially irresponsible parents. That this new person in your life, their sort of save their pennies way of being, even if it results in them being sort of miserly and not particularly generous, may still strangely feel good and may get turned into a narrative that feels safe. Another example could be that someone grew up with a very weak father and the father was railroaded by your narcissistic mother or by their narcissistic boss. And then you meet a man who had qualities such as decisiveness, maybe even physical strength. That might be something you experience as good stuff. And unless you pay attention, you may feel stuck in what you're thinking is this good thing, which stops being good after a while if the person has narcissistic patterns. But the narrative is already written about it. Sometimes the good is merely that they are the opposite of your former toxic partner. So the original partner you had, the original narcissistic partner, may have come home late all the time and been shady and dodgy and betrayally. The new partner may be self-righteous and controlling and cold, but they don't cheat. And those good things that feel hard to leave or felt like a lot to lose, it's easy when you're navigating the very confusing aftermath of a narcissistic relationship to get lost in the stuff you lost instead of focusing on why these things even felt like good things you lost. The origin story of the stuff that felt compelling, the stuff you miss, the stuff you still think about it. Dig deeper. Why was it good? Now listen, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Maybe you just miss the good sex or their blue eyes. But you also may miss the sense of family you created, holiday traditions, a home. And even though they treated you badly within those structures, they may have been overriding of what you didn't get in childhood, for example. You may miss the feeling and the tension reduction that would come from the breakup makeup cycles. It may have reproduced that sense of being able to win over that unavailable parent. You may miss the times your narcissistic partner would come back after an infidelity and that dynamic of being chosen and hoovered. It's a powerful one if that didn't happen for you in childhood. And that could be the good thing, but those aren't good things. They're just powerful counterweights. And frankly, the more that these good things tie into these deeper origin stories, the more they can make you feel stuck and missing your narcissistic relationship and not being able to mentally let it go and even not always even able to articulate what's the good stuff you miss. But a big step to mentally letting it go is figuring out what made the good feel good. And was it good or was it evocative? Was it familiar or was it a triumph? Was the little kid in you getting the win where you didn't as a child? Was it the false sense of safety you got in the narcissistic relationship because it was so different than your origin story? Dig into that. And as you do, you may feel some of that rumination lift and you may get not only a hell of a lot more clarity, but you may not feel as sort of stuck in the post-relationship landscape. Folks, we always make it about abandonment in these relationships and that we're afraid the relationships end because we're afraid of abandonment. But it's also losing the sense of this moment that we thought we could actually be ourselves in a relationship. So you all know on this channel that I get very frustrated at content that focuses on the idea that some people are just narcissist magnets and attract them, or all the codependency nonsense. I just don't agree with it when it comes to narcissistic relationships. One could easily argue, and I would, that we are all to some degree vulnerable to narcissistic relationships, and that there may be certain vulnerability factors in us that may make us more likely to get stuck. But I have yet to meet the person who is fully immune to charm, charisma, confidence, and attractiveness. Narcissistic folks are very beautiful in the beginning when we first meet them, and nobody says no to someone who's beautiful. Then, as it always does in a narcissistic relationship, these relationships transition into devalue and discard and fall apart. They always do. There is no version of the narcissistic relationship where this doesn't happen, unless you just have the capacity to break up with them during the love bomb stage. And that's pretty rare for someone to do that. And as the relationship unfolds, you're confused. And most of us at this point don't run away from the narcissistic relationship, even once they start devaluing and discarding us. But instead, we are more likely to wonder what we are doing wrong. Because after all, just a month ago, the relationship was everything we ever wanted, right? We thought we were falling deeply in love, that this was our person. It was as though they could read our mind. I'll say more about that in this video. We believed this was real. And real can't go so wrong so fast, right? So to maintain some sense of control, which is very common, that we're going to blame ourselves. Now, one of the quick armchair takes on this is that, oh, well, people don't want to leave the narcissistic relationship because of abandonment issues, right? Many people who are going through the devalue or discard phase will wonder, well, maybe I'm not leaving because I have abandonment issues. And if I leave, like, I don't want them to find someone else. And then they'll do a deep analysis and a deep dive of their childhood and past relationships and pin it all to abandonment. And I have no doubt that there is some truth to the abandonment hypothesis for more than a few people. But it's not all. Every person in a narcissistic relationship is not a person with abandonment issues, not by a long shot. I want you to sit a moment, though, and take a minute, and think about what is the one thing we most want in a relationship? Because there's a right answer to this question. What is the one thing we want, crave, have wanted since we were born? And if you were lucky, you got it as an infant and in childhood. And if you don't get this thing, then you crave it like hell as you go through childhood into adolescence and adulthood. It's a deeply human thing to want, even need, and it can get us into a lot of trouble in narcissistic relationships. What is it? You can even pause the video here. You can drop your answer in the comments. It's pretty simple. And the answer is to be seen. That's it. That's the core of love. It's not gifts or epic sex or a fairy tale romance or gorgeous face or money or a gorgeous body or even charm or charisma. It's not compassion. It's to be seen, to be really seen, maybe to be experienced in that way. All of us needed and wanted as small children to be seen. And then as we get into adulthood, to extend that to someone who gets us and sees our strength and loves us through our weaknesses, who loves our quirks, notices our gifts, who can see we're having a bad day and gives us a shoulder rub or a gentle smile, and on a good day is happy for us. That's what we want. And when we find it, it feels magical. And it can be the beginning of a love story. We want this in our friends. We want this in people we work with. Listen, we'd even take it from a stranger to be seen. Think of your truly good relationships in your life, even if you just have one. one relationship in your life you consider good. Why is it good? Because you feel seen by them, and odds are that you see them too, and it feels so real. We are social creatures. We even have neuronal systems in our brain that need this seenness, and we give that seenness back. Here's the problem. In the first 6 weeks of a relationship, narcissistic people are world-class ICUers. They are almost magical at it. They tell you that your so-called weaknesses that you've confessed to them don't matter, that they love you more because of them. They tell you about your strengths, your beauty, all the things they like about you, adore about you, and love in you. And you do the same for them. You are being sculpted into perfect supply. But that is happening at the same time that you are finally feeling seen, seen, seen. You may look back at past relationships where your quirks and preferences and things that make you you may have been devalued or minimized. And then this new partner comes along and tells you they love your cats and that they love you even though you come from a wacky, crazy family and that you have curves in all the right places and they love your creative side. All the things you have always wanted to be seen, they see, and they don't criticize, and it feels like the ultimate correction of all the bad things that have happened in the past. And not only are you seen, you may feel, after even a few weeks of this, or certainly a month or two of this, you may feel like you can open up and be your true self. Finally be vulnerable after years or even decades of being a clenched soul. Because to feel we can show up as our authentic selves with someone is one of the most beautiful, divine, and transcendent feelings in the world. The narcissistic person's capacity for charm, charisma, and CIA-level interrogation in a way that you don't even know you're being interrogated to get classified information out of you can bring down our walls pretty quickly. Because they are showing up with that thing we all want to be seen, that normal and human thing to want, because once they have you there, I hate to say it, but it's like a boxer getting an opponent on the ropes. They have you, and they know it. The reason love bombing works and can show up in so many different ways is because being seen means different things to all of us. For example, I'll put myself out there. For with a person like me, if a person showed up with luxe gifts and a fancy car, not only would that not win me over, it would turn me off. That doesn't feel like being seen to someone like me. But to another person, it may feel very much like being seen. To another person, someone wanting to be with them all the time would feel like being seen. To another person, it might feel like too much. For me, being seen as someone emptying the dishwasher and taking out the trash cans. We all got a thing. The narcissistic love bomber calibrates to what the person wants and ultimately finds their best match in someone who wants the things that they are offering. They search for the vulnerabilities, which they may do this by saying things like, I want this to be a deep and honest relationship. Really tell me about you. And then that interrogation begins. But you think it's just profound intimacy. But rather, it's a process of learning your buttons. Buttons that will be pushed and used to manipulate you once the devalue phase begins. So the reason so many people get stuck in these relationships isn't necessarily fear of abandonment or so-called abandonment issues, but rather, it's about letting go of the experience of being what felt like, at least for a moment, of being really seen. Hundreds of survivors have said to me that this is what they're struggling with in the wake of a narcissistic relationship ending. Letting go of what felt so connected, so unique, so being seen. It's not about abandonment. As much as it is the loss of that acutely important and human need and want to be seen. the need we have had since the day we were born. In fact, we may not even actually miss the narcissistic person as much as we miss what for a moment in time felt like a perfect mirror. I'm going to briefly share two stories here to sort of bring this to life. One was a person who had had back-to-back unhealthy relationships with men that were riddled with infidelity, and she had kind of given up. And then was introduced to someone who a group of her friends believed would be a good match. He was physically her type, handsome guy, and it seemed that in a very brief period of time, he sort of got her. The classical, their first date went until sunrise. It was almost as though he was purpose-built for her and she for him. He knew exactly what to say to her to allay her fears. He cared about the same things as her. He didn't mock some of her quirky things that everyone, including her friends, would sometimes poke at. On his side, in her, he found someone. She herself was quite financially successful. She was connected to lots of powerful people. So he got lots of supply, and he himself was going through a relatively rough patch financially. So he was kind of drawn to, I don't know, the splendor of her world. The devalue in their relationship started about after 6 months. And those things he would compliment her on and those vulnerabilities she shared because she felt seen and she felt safe were now constantly being derided. And that included her friends, her family, her home, the way she spent money, the stuff in her refrigerator. But she had told herself the story that he ticked all the boxes and that people didn't see what he was like when nobody was around. Needless to say, it didn't end well after many, many years. Cheating, hoovering, the whole thing. The woman in this relationship was not a person with abandonment issues, but rather, for her, the seeming miracle of finding someone that she believed for a moment really saw her meant that 5 months of that became five very difficult years. I've been here too. Being seen is a big psychological issue for me, I'll own it. And so I was vulnerable to getting stuck repeatedly. It took me becoming much older to work that shit through. But it meant that when someone seemed to get me and be okay with what I thought were weaknesses in me that nobody would put up with, oh, how I wish for a do-over, I put up with terrible abuse as part of that narcissistic transaction. And all of this highlights why, for example, a person who, for example, was invalidated and never seen as a child, which is a lot of people, or someone who's very isolated, could be very vulnerable to that dynamic of being seen. If this is something that has not happened to someone before, a skilled narcissistic person with that capacity to engage in the short-term seeing during the love-bombing phase will not only be able to control a person in a situation like this more quickly, but it will be more difficult for a person with this kind of history to extricate. When someone shows up with that thing we have never had but are wired to need and want, it is a profound power, and all of that interest the narcissistic person shows and the questions they ask and seemingly listen to our answers without judgment in the beginning can feel initially liberating. But sadly, over time, the narcissistic person may simply be learning about your vulnerabilities so that they can be more easily weaponized down the road. Wanting to be seen and wanting to be vulnerable is healthy and good. But unfortunately, narcissistic folks are really good at mimicry and at playing at that, turning us into perfect supply and leaving us grasping and fighting for that experience, that short-lived experience of being seen in the relationship to continue. It ain't an abandonment issue. But as with all things in narcissistic relationships, the good stuff never lasts. As I've said repeatedly, the challenge raised by narcissistic relationships, it's not the issue of getting us getting into them. It's the issue of us getting stuck in them. The getting out is what is hard, especially after stuff like trauma bonding kicks in, as well as the enabling by people who keep telling you stuff like, give it a chance, or I'm sure they don't mean it when they say that or do that, and then the confusion of all of it, and especially if this feel is a repeat of what things were like, for example, in a narcissistic family system, it's hard. And if it feels unsafe to leave, then it's even more difficult. But this cycle starts even earlier. So let's break this down a little bit. It starts first with the idea that I am bad for seeing this new person as bad. In essence, you are judging yourself for seeing red flags. That's often where this process starts. People will feel like, oh, maybe I'm judgmental. Maybe I'm the overly critical one. Maybe I'm the problem. When you may spot behavior, especially early on, that is gaslighting or toxic or manipulative. Remember, this uncomfortable, unhealthy behavior is inevitably embedded within this larger context of these good things or charming things or attractive things that they're doing. They may do something that feels considerate. You may have fun with them. This person may make you laugh. There may be days that they do nice things for you. And remember, in the early days of a relationship, it's not as though you have a history with them. So then, when they do a bad thing, it's still embedded in this larger context of doing some nice things. And especially if you grew up with this kind of backing and forthing between some good things and a lot of bad things, and frankly, even if you didn't, you do believe when you notice those bad things that I'm being too demanding. Maybe my standards are too high. Maybe I'm asking too much. No wonder I'm single. I ask for too much. Or that you're a bad person for seeing their behavior as manipulative or gaslighting or as invalidation or betrayal. And you may also have other people say to you, oh, come on now. Nobody's perfect. But this isn't about perfect. If you're in a relationship with someone who's, for example, who acts like a victim every time things don't go their way, this is about that, or it's about someone who may tell you lies when it works for them. Or it may be that you're in a relationship with a person who's dismissive of what matters to you. But hey, they bought you dinner and paid for all of your friends to go away for a birthday weekend, so that erases the slate, right? And that you're a bad person for seeing them as bad because they did that nice thing. And this is a tiny but important shift that ends up happening in the relationship, because now that part of you, bad you, now that bad you's in the house. And you may consider bad you to be demanding you, unrealistic expectation having you, needy you. And so you may then make more allowances for their bad behavior and overappreciate the good stuff they do. But one day you can't not see these patterns. The relationship becomes increasingly uncomfortable. The emotional abuse keeps mounting up. You find yourself more and more hypervigilant, walking on eggshells. You feel like you can't be yourself. You start staying quiet because you don't want to make them mad. But hey, you're the one who's bad too, right? You're the one who has unrealistic standards. You're the one with unrealistic expectations. And maybe that's why the relationship is so bad, right? It's all your fault. So that same way you thought you were a problem in the beginning of the relationship for noticing some of those red flags, for thinking that meant you had unrealistic standards, now you think you're just a bad person and a problem, full stop, and that it's your identity. And the narcissistic person is saying it more in the relationship, saying things to you like, you aren't affectionate enough, you aren't nice enough, you ask for too much, you're greedy, you're selfish. You aren't available. You're just not enough. You're a problem. Well, now, even if you do start to see these behaviors in the relationship as bad, well, that belief system has seeped into you, and now you view yourself as bad too, as you're a problem too. So you may not feel like you have grounds to push back or leave, because maybe you stay even because you feel like, oh, I don't have a strong argument to leave this. I suck. They suck. This all sucks. And then you feel stuck. And you may not see it. And that's the real problem. Betrayal blindness is real. That idea of not seeing what is happening in the relationship happens not because you are in denial, not because you are dumb, not because you're a codependent, but because there is a cost to seeing the bad things happening in the relationship. At first, you may not really understand what is happening, sure, but the real issue becomes that there is a cost to seeing it. You may feel that you can't stay in it, or that if you see the bad things happening, that means ending it to you. And then you may forestall something that matters to you, like getting married or having children, or maybe you already have children or live together, or you have your own wounds and fears about being abandoned or being alone. There is a sort of protective process around not fully encoding the small and big betrayals. And it sort of does have a big payoff. If you, it means you can stay. If you don't see it, you can stay. And if you stay, then you don't have to endure the anxiety, the fear, the disruption to life and to the trauma bond that can fill us with panic. Now, it's not like that bad stuff that you were betrayal blind to doesn't enter your psyche. It does. And all that betrayal sort of piles up in a big dysfunctional pile of ick in your brain. And you start feeling things like anxious and physically ill, disconnected, numb, dysregulated. You don't feel like yourself. So the not seeing is not intentional, it's protective. And you stay because those reasons, those betrayals, the reasons to leave, kind of get sort of cordoned off in your brain. You don't sort of see them. So you don't do anything, you remain stuck in the relationship, but one day you see it. And this is the moment where perhaps the betrayal happens right in front of you, or someone else is there and sees it too, or someone else tells you, or someone else shows you the evidence, or the evidence shows up on an iCloud account and you can't not see it, or they treat a friend of yours really rudely, or they start poking at things in your life that feel like sacred no-fly zones, like a beloved family member or your children or a belief you hold. Whatever it is, they go there. And then betrayal blindness be damned, you see it. And that moment to get there, it can take months, it can take years, it can take decades. And some of that relates actually to what you learn about narcissism. Some of it relates to the supports you have access to, like friends or family or therapy or having other resources in your life. But one day you do see it. Well, the discomfort doesn't go away then. You see it, and then you feel shame. Lots and lots and lots of shame. Asking yourself and feeling, why did I wait so long? Why didn't I leave sooner? I knew years ago that this sucked, and now it's public, or it's really humiliating, or people knew for a while, or I knew for a while, and I didn't do anything. So once again, instead of turning the lens where it belongs, that this other person behaved badly and hurtfully, no. We then focus on the shame that we waited so long to do anything or even see it. We talk about ourselves as codependents and as part of the problem or as foolish. We may not talk about it at all because we feel humiliated. We may feel numb and then overwhelmed with anger and emotion. And people looking at us may see this strong emotion and judge us harshly too. And above all else, you feel shame, but the fact is, you've been feeling shame for a while. These relationships only work if you are willing to carry the burden of all of the shame in the relationship. If you are willing to carry their projected shame and the shame that grows for you as you stay longer and longer in these relationships, and even when you are betrayal blind, there's a sort of knowing in your body, so that shame quietly builds up. It takes a minute for our minds to catch up. And so even when we start to feel unstuck in these relationships, the shame can still keep us in that mindset that we had from the early days when we felt we were bad people for spying these red flags, these toxic patterns. But now we think of ourselves as foolish. We didn't see it. We're the ones who are needy. Some people still manage to get out at this point. Sometimes the narcissistic person leaves the relationship at this point. And a lot of people still remain stuck at this point. Strangely, we almost need to be bad in our minds for these relationships to work. And work, I think, is a bad term. I guess maybe I mean for these relationships to move forward, to sustain. And I've talked about this before in a video I did on debasement. You can go check that out. That basically we have to eat our own shit for these relationships to work. The narcissistic person can't be bad. Their own psyche doesn't tolerate that framework for themselves, at least not consciously. So we carry that projected burden. But the real challenge is that all of this seeps into our identity. And for a long time, sometimes a lifetime, we walk around and are always quick to take the blame. We know if we do that, then conflicts can be averted, trains can keep running on time, and that is what keeps things from escalating. We view ourselves as the problem, as the people who are just too damaged to make relationships work. And we put ourselves in a real sort of bind, in a can't-win situation. Because in the beginning of the relationship, we felt we were too quick to judge. And at the end, we felt that we were too slow in seeing it all, and we are foolish for staying. And we are full of shame on both ends of the relationship. The stuckness in these relationships is tough to break for a lot of reasons. Because it may not feel safe to leave, because of family court, because of finances, because of lack of support. But it's also tough to break for that reason, that we have to integrate this belief that we are bad because of our shame. These relationships are, in essence, it can almost feel like we're being programmed to become supply, to devalue ourselves, and to put another person's needs first all the time. And to keep accepting the narcissistic person's shame until it becomes our own. So many survivors blame themselves for letting it go on for too long and looking back and recognizing that the unhealthy cycles were present from the beginning. It contributes to all of the blame and shame. But you can and have to put the spotlight where it belongs. A person who is in a relationship with you emotionally mistreated you, and that's the problem. And parts of you, like your empathy, and even the pressure from the world to see the good in people, or give people a chance, or the benefit of the doubt, all of that combines to make it more likely that we get stuck in very unhealthy relationships. But it's their toxic and manipulative behavior that's the actual issue, not your badness. We have this unrealistic ideal of what the perfect survivor looks like. The perfect survivor is someone who doesn't leave too soon, but also who doesn't stay in the relationship too long. As though there is this perfect inflection point when you get just enough data, so you have just enough proof to show the world, so you can leave without people questioning you, but that you don't leave too soon, so you aren't viewed as judgmental, but you don't stay too long, so you don't look foolish. And of course, none of that accounts for processes like trauma bonding and manipulation, any of it. We aren't robots that crunch data and make personal decisions on the basis of algorithms. We are emotional. We are human beings. We want connection. We need connection. And we make allowances in the name of love. And the fact is, most of us were never taught what a healthy relationship looks like. But to see how a story begins with you feeling bad about seeing the red flags, ultimately ending up in a place of feeling shame about not seeing the red flags soon enough, all of that gives you a sense of how treacherous these relationships really are. And brings up that constant reminder that I always highlight, that you can't win. But understanding is a really important step to winning. Relationships end for lots of reasons. These can include lack of communication, incompatibility, differences in financial styles, work styles, how you think about money, wrong place, wrong time, right person, wanting different things. And frankly, I view these as sort of the healthy reasons relationships might end. personally, that what I think that they speak to fundamental difference that at this time in history, people can reflect on and say, no, whatever this is, it's not working for me, and continuing to keep this relationship on life support can lead the people in the relationship to stop growing together or even to stop growing altogether. And so sometimes the people in the relationship, based on some of these kinds of differences, end it. And some of them even stay friends, or at least they don't have long-term bad blood. Then I come back into my lane, and I think about narcissistic relationships. And the reasons that narcissistic relationships end can be quite different. For example, because the narcissistic person went to get new supply. Because you started to feel like you were experiencing symptoms of complex trauma. Because it's one of many breakups you have, and you just keep going between breakup and hoovering cycles, and it's an unhealthy breakup makeup cycle, and that's the only way that the relationship works. Now, all that other stuff I listed, the lack of communication and the financial stuff and all the other stuff, that stuff may have been happening. But in narcissistic relationships, that's actually often not why it ends. The ending of narcissistic relationships and all the associated confusion, but the ending is never smooth. And there is typically long-term bad blood and lots of icky stuff like rumination, sadness, self-blame, you know the drill. I was recently reading a scientific journal article about relationships, and they got to this idea in the article of final straws. The relationship was rolling along, but the person in the relationship that they were interviewing in the study said that they split up, that they ended the relationship, or that the reason the relationship ended was because the folks said they hit the final straw. And there were three very consistent final straws that the researchers found: substance and alcohol use, domestic violence, and or infidelity. When one of those came into the picture, that was often cited as what ended the relationship. Now, in many cases, these final straws were very likely happening alongside other really unhealthy relationship patterns. But final straws are tricky, because final straws don't always happen in a relationship, and they don't always happen in narcissistic relationships. Narcissistic relationships are a confused mess. Trauma bonded, maybe there's something I can change in myself, maybe it's my fault, maybe it's not that bad, maybe they didn't mean it, they said they're going to therapy, lots of people seem to like them, maybe I can find a way to say it differently. Or just in general, these relationships are unsettling. Things like, if I leave, I am going to get eviscerated in the divorce. Or you may have a fear of a smear campaign or custody battles. And or most people you know doubting you or maybe even shutting you out. Ending a narcissistic relationship is not about a lack of compatibility. Sometimes these relationships don't get ended because we are just trying to survive. So that takes us back to those final straws. I have no doubt that many of you in narcissistic relationships might have made a final straw your hard line in the sand. I'm out of here if they cheat. If they don't stop drinking, or if they get a DUI, or if they ever lay hands on me, I'm out. Those are things you see, and the things you can see. Those are things you may sometimes, hopefully, many times, be able to get support for. If people think you're married to an alcoholic or a cheater or a physical abuser, you probably are more likely to get support compared to someone who's citing emotional abuse. And even then, you're not always likely to get support. But if you say that you're being gaslighted or don't feel emotionally safe or that you're being chronically invalidated or minimized,
litavazende kize imba izwezipiri loekerze mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza kwankufisa hamocholo ni mata amskavona kale kana mitukserize kubona msevelezo wa imba ye mufumane lisevelezo zezwezipiri ze kakulipafela mashering ali kana $36 kakweli kapa kamikwaye kutesifafasi ye tatama 5% machipisa hamngolisalikwelize talu 10% machipisa hamngolisalikwelize silela 25% machipisa hamngolisalikwelize lishumiperi muketeli kwelizo zo muvata kuri mukone kukala kuikola zendeze wo imba imiswale zifana chipisa imba tokubukanira fasi kaufela mwipe kwali sevelezo za imba kachenu kuri mukone kuikola zende kaufela.
You're more likely to face up to people who may say, well, it takes two to tango, etc., etc., or relationships are hard. You know the drill. Even those folks who do end these relationships on the basis of incompatibility or communication issues, they'll face some of that, why did you end your relationship, heat. The difference is that if they are not in a relationship with a narcissistic person, then they don't experience the same kind of destabilization that happens when you are in a narcissistic relationship. And even if people are critical of you leaving, you may feel you have more psychological safety as you decide to leave the relationship and aren't expending lots of bandwidth on how do I leave this without ruining my life. Now, these final straws are not a given in a narcissistic relationship. And while these final straws are not uncommon in narcissistic relationships, not all narcissistic relationships get there. And some folks wait. They wait for a final straw. In fact, it's sort of a dark future fake within yourself. Someday if I catch them cheating, I'm out. Or I'll get him on video throwing something at me and then I'm out. There is so much self-gaslighting that happens in these relationships that these final straw type things can even substantiate your sense that, see, they did that. I deserve to leave. I have the right to leave. Or simply, you'll say, this is real, see? So I can leave. And the drug and alcohol one is tricky in narcissistic relationships. There's a lot of overlap with a substantial chunk, in fact, some studies estimate almost half, of people living with addiction or problem substance or alcohol use also have antagonistic personality styles like narcissism. Again, a lot of overlap. And for a long time, you may think their general assholery is due to intoxication or just being an addict. But should they get sober, the assholery goes nowhere. And the behavior can get worse because now they no longer have drugs and alcohol regulating them at all times. So you may now deal with even more rage. But even then, for example, if their alcohol use, they were so disinhibited and impulsive, it culminated in violence or something that put you or your children in danger, like driving under the influence, that would be something more final straw-esque. And thinking about leaving and not doubting yourself about it may feel more accessible. I wouldn't argue that final straws always break the trauma bond. In some cases, they may. A sort of breaking out of the dance of thinking, well, sometimes it isn't bad because you simply cannot unsee some of these final straw type of things. You can't unsee them happening. But many people remain in narcissistically abusive or other abusive relationships for reasons above and beyond just feeling that if they leave, that their lives are in danger. And those reasons are often related to the trauma-bonded patterns. I mean, the statistic is often circulated that on average, people in abusive relationships go back 7 times before finally leaving. The final straws, however, may result in other people giving more pointed advice in terms of giving you more support in therapists or other people around the situation, being more direct in what they believe you can do, or even in other advocacy resources being available to you. And listen, there are narcissistic relationships that do hit the final straw point, and that are not nearly as unhealthy and harmful as those relationships that don't hit the final straw point. The cumulative harms of psychological abuse in a relationship do not get adequately accounted for. In cases of coercive control, there may never be physical violence or drug and alcohol use or infidelity. But the people in those relationships are absolutely terrorized and imprisoned, even though the doors aren't literally locked, though sometimes they are. Remember, it's called a final straw for a reason. Because there were lots of straws up to that point. And most of those other straws are not as clear cut and is often the day-to-day crap of the narcissistic relationship. Lots of bad relationship, like Lifetime movies and news stories and all the rest, are about these final straw relationships. I have almost never seen the one that doesn't go there, where there's not final straw stuff, but lots of little straws. And we have full empathy for the survivors in those final straw movies. But what we do not see is the day-to-day death by a thousand cuts, the chipping away of a person through multiple daily indignities. Sadly, in our cultures, even in the most unhealthy and toxic of these, they may still be viewed as, well, that's marriage, or no relationship is always easy. Don't get me wrong. People in final straw relationships are definitely suffering, and many have been suffering for a long time. But for those of you in long-term narcissistic relationships who feel unheard and unseen and also confused because you haven't hit a final straw or don't feel you have a good enough reason to consider maybe that this relationship isn't good for you, or you're gaslighting yourselves in the absence of that so-called last straw, sometimes they don't come. And I gotta tell you, I've seen this repeatedly in my career, even when they do. People in narcissistic relationships especially will future fake themselves and say, okay, yeah, I know, I'd say I'd leave if they cheated, but I just saw a text. Maybe it wasn't that bad. Or they said they'd go to therapy. Or they didn't throw that thing at me. They just threw it at the other side of the room. In narcissistic relationships, that damned camel has a really strong back. And one final straw rarely breaks it. Thanks again.
Ooh la la. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My dear, how are we not learning, my dear? It is hectic out here in the living world, man. It's hectic. People are going through a lot. We are going through a lot. And it is wild. Like I said, right? What is it? It is so dangerous, or it's such a bad thing, ne? If your breakup has to involve police, guys. Hey, if you guys can just break up nicely, and then you guys have to break up with police. Police presence. We need police presence for this altercation. How it's deep if it hits that level. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm asking of you guys is to take care of yourselves, huh? To take care of yourselves, to think about yourselves, to think about the situations in which you are in, and to find a way to work on it. Now, I always encourage therapy, 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 therapy. Go to therapy, guys. And if the situation is very difficult, go to a psychiatrist and they will give you some medication. I know that a lot of us, or a lot of people, because me, I'm on the other side. Me, I believe in medication. I believe in medication. I want medication. Give me medication, whether it is traditional medication or spiritual medication or pharmaceutical medication. I want medication, guys, because getting better is the whole point, is the whole deal. And also, when you're a parent, you can't afford to not be well. You can't afford to not be at the prime of your life. You cannot afford to be slacking. You can't be caught sleeping. So I always encourage, like, let's go to therapy. Let's go to therapy and find ways to cope with what we have been going through. And also, we can only fight things that we know. We can only fight things that we understand, and we can only fight an enemy that we can see. So now, if you are feeling the way that you are feeling and you are not going to anyone, you are just feeling the way you are feeling, and you know that you don't normally feel like this. And the thing with psychological stuff, right, is that you feel off. You feel off, you feel displaced in some way in your body, you know, you feel like your behavior, your mind, you can feel it, man. You can feel that, Elizabeth, Maitreak, apa, pano punasha, pano, definitely, pano punasha. If you can feel it, right, then how about you go to somebody that can diagnose it, that can tell you what it is? So when you are told what it is, right, you can now learn about it. And when you learn about it, you can now understand the world around you and the world within. You can understand yourself, you see? You can understand yourself, you can understand where you are at, you can understand where you are going, you can understand, fully understand, right? Where you are at so that you can get better. So that you can no longer be in that loop. Imagine being in a loop for 10 years. And you are just running, yeah? You're just running in circles with your mind, with yourself. You're just running. It gets so tiring. And you don't know how to explain to people that you're tired. You don't know how to explain to people that you're just not it. You're not feeling it. You're not within. You're not Jesni Tarni. You don't know how to explain it. But I can guarantee you that there's somebody that can explain it for you. There's somebody that can explain it for you. And it's also free there at stake. All it does is cost just a little bit of time. But what is a couple of hours to a lifetime of peace and tranquility? What is a couple of hours to a balanced life? I don't think that it is bad for us to go to therapy. I don't think that it is bad for us to seek and sought help. I don't think it's bad for us to go into the realm of looking out for yourself. Because if it was your child that had an issue, you would take them instantly. If it was a partner, if it was somebody, you would take them. You would make that observation and take them so that they can get assistance. But we are more shaky when it comes to ourselves. I think that maybe it is not self-love. It is more, it's not self-love that we don't have. It is more about, I think it's more about shame that we are feeling the way we are feeling, that we are in the positions in which we're in, that we are in unhealthy situations. And intimacy is into me, you see, right? Intimacy is important. And if you can rekindle the fire, right? And it can be reciprocated. Then the relationship goes a little bit further. The problem is that sometimes the intimacy is not reciprocated, and then you go into this stonewalling phase, or you go into this eggshell, or you go back into your cave, and because of the rejection that is faced now from having, you know, making advances. And these advances are not met, they are not seen, they are not appreciated, they are not even noticed, right? And this can look like rejection, but up until you talk about it, up until you do it, right? It will still just be a myth. It will still just be something that's in your head. Now you can talk about it, and then you can hear from the horse's mouth that, hey, I am indeed avoiding you. Then if you can hear that one, then you know that, okay, so I am being rejected. And that's why there is no intimacy. And maybe you can find out the reasons as to why you're being rejected. I think that we need to work on things at other people's pace as well. And we also need to understand when it's other people's turn. When someone is hurt, someone is not okay. I think that it's only fair that we take chances and in carrying the emotional burden and the emotional load within our partnerships, be it our friendships, be it our partnerships, be it our everything. If we can take the burden off of somebody's shoulder so that we can carry it, I think the world would be a better place. And if the world is going to be a better place, it should be. So, today I was thinking of, is it Ricky Rick? He used to end his slogans, or he used to end his things with, if I never see you again, you should know that I love you. And that's a wild thing. That's a wild thing to listen to. Or that's a wild thing to hear, because one day it was true. But from me, the matriarch, I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day. You are important to me. And you will see me again tomorrow. Same time, same place. It is what it is. We shall overcome. We shall overcome one day. Yeah. Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen. Bye bye.